Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Franchise Interviews, where we're asking the franchisepreneur who owns one. I'm your host, Marty McDermott, with my co-host, Diamond Don Johnson, and if you've ever dreamed of owning your own business, you've come to the right place. Today's a very special show. It's our very first Franchise Attorney Symposium. For the next 3 hours, you're going to hear from some of the most knowledgeable franchise attorneys in the country, Nancy Lenard, Kevin Hines, Holly Shilliday, and Scott Sandberg. And that's coming up on Franchise Interviews, so stick around because we've got an incredible show.
Are you one of those special people who are willing to go after your dreams and goals? Are you ready to fulfill that dream of owning your own business with the security of a proven brand, the opportunity to take control of your future and own a Rita's Italian Ice franchise is within your reach?
Rita's is seeking success-oriented individuals who are ready to make a change in their life, and Rita's offers unparalleled training and support to assure your success. And did you know the frozen treat industry is a recession-proof industry, and there are Rita's in 23 states currently with 540 stores open. Rita's Italian Ice has been around for 25 years and is listed as a top-performing franchise by the Wall Street Journal.
Now here's the really good part. Rita's Italian Ice is a unique and amazing taste treat. It's smoother than a snow cone, and it combines ice with real fresh fruit. The real fruit adds dramatically to the taste, and it comes in over 40 flavors. The ice and fruit are mixed on site and made fresh daily, and it is delicious.
You'll want to know more about this exciting and successful franchise opportunity. Go to www.ownaritas.com and get all your questions answered. That's www.ownaritas.com to take control of your dreams and future today. You don't want to wait any longer to be a part of this adventure. www.ownaritas.com. Franchise Interviews. For over 2 years now, Franchise Interviews has been giving you an up-close, behind-the-scenes look at franchising and entrepreneurship.
Through our website, franchiseinterviews.com, where you can hear and read interviews, as well as get tips from some of the most successful sources in franchising.
And our weekly franchise radio show, where each week you get to hear a new interview with franchisors, franchisees, franchise authors, experts, and attorneys.
And our free franchise newsletter, which is a must-read for anyone looking to buy a franchise.
And don't forget to listen to our podcast, Great Quotes in Franchising. For more information, go to franchiseinterviews.com or call us at 610-905-2919.
That's 610-905-2919.
Topic that affects both franchisees and the franchisors. By having a strong tenant review lease, the franchisee is in a stronger financial position,
right,
better able to focus his or her attention on the business and not on issues of the lease. I mean, this is something that could really...
make or break a business, yeah.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, as Nancy mentioned, you know, you want to, you know, focus on the business. You don't want to, you know, stay up at night, you know, focusing on the...
Right.
So,
and you think it's pretty simple. Okay, I'm renting space. Hey, there's a price, and I agree to it. You know, possibly try bargaining a little. But there's so many components of the whole lease
Hey,
Nancy, how you doing? I apologize about that, Nancy.
We've had a little technical difficulty.
Yes,
how are you this morning?
Good. How are you today, Nancy?
I'm doing great, thank you.
That's great, great. Nancy, as you, I think you remember Don Johnson. I know, John, you wanted to say hi to Nancy.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Good, Nancy. Appreciate you coming back on the show. I think it's been a while. I think Marty said maybe it was about a year ago we had you on, so I'm sure you're pretty busy these days with everything.
My pleasure. Absolutely. It's an exciting time in the franchise world.
Yeah, it sure is. You know, I want to thank you again for coming on the show, Nancy, and congratulate you. You know, there was a great article in the Costco Connection on franchising. Don and I discussed that article. I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks, Don, and it was a section that you were actually referencing. It was called Fend Off Franchise Fiascos, and I just thought that was fantastic. I mean, that's such a huge circulation from what I understand.
Six million business members of Costco received that, plus anyone who was in a Costco warehouse club could pick it up. It was very exciting to be called upon as a legal expert for that article, and it's still available on Costco's website. You can connect on it, or on my website, you can connect on it.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was a great article, too, Nancy. I thought they did a very good job. You know,
it was. It was very, I think, very balanced.
It sure was, absolutely. Nancy, I thought a good place to start off is if you could tell our listeners, why is it so important for a prospective franchisee to hire a franchise attorney?
Well, for a number of reasons. And, you know, I get this question all the time because, obviously, you know, people are very concerned about their costs going into purchasing and investing in a franchise. But I think it's critical because often the people that are buying franchises have never owned a business and really have not had a great deal of experience in the business world. And even those who may have been you know, employees of other businesses, this is their first time being in the business world owning a business. And truly, the accountant and the attorney that they would be retaining to advise them on this and to be a part of their team are really the only people, truly, that have no other interest other than to be serving the best interests of that franchisee. We're on their team. We are there to advise them. And to help them through the whole process and to help them understand what it is that they are investing in, because it is a huge investment.
Right.
And it should be looked at as part of the overall investment. Sometimes people think, well, attorney, it's you know, high fees and stuff like that. But like you said, it's so imperative, it's a must that you have to get the advice of someone like yourself, because there's so much on the line here. It's a big investment in a franchise. It's a long-term agreement. So you have to have that expert advice.
I agree 100%. And plus, we're available then to help them with setting up their legal entity as a corporation or as a limited liability company, and to help them with the lease for their location if they are going to be operating out of a separate location and not be home-based. And so, you know, the full-service representation, we could even help them with employment policies and establishing an employment handbook. I have articles on my website that talk about what to do with employee theft and you know, how you prevent it and what happens when it happens. So we're here to really help through the whole process of running their franchise from the legal end.
Right. Absolutely. I love how you mentioned, too, Nancy, you guys are deal makers, not deal breakers.
Absolutely. And I think that's very important to understand. You know, my background is that I, as an attorney, was raised in the world of working as an in-house attorney for various large corporations, the last of which was Nutrisystem, Inc., which is not the same as Nutrisystem today. It was a different company. They had 1,800 franchise and corporate locations internationally and nationally, and I was an in-house attorney for them. And as such, when you have one client, which you do when you're an in-house attorney, that is also your employer, you better figure out how to make a deal happen, because if you keep saying no, you're not going to have a job very long.
That's right.
So you become a deal maker because you become very creative in how to make the deal happen. It may not be exactly the way it's initially presented to you, but you figure out ways to make it happen. And I think that's a very different background than an attorney who has grown up in the world of working in a law firm, where you're much more worried about, you know, how do I protect myself as an attorney than how do I protect my client and make the deal happen.
Absolutely. Can you explain to our listeners, Nancy, about the franchise disclosure document, formerly known as the UFOC, and some of the new changes in the FDD?
It's an interesting time, as I said at the beginning, for the franchise world, because Last March, the Federal Trade Commission that governs the and regulates franchising nationally issued a new regulation, modified its old regulation, and this was the first time in decades since the franchise law had really changed. And so the old format of the UFOC is being phased out as of July 1 of 07. It was optional for a franchisor to convert to the new format, and as of July 1st of 08, it becomes mandatory. So after July 1st of 08, every new disclosure document will be in the format of a franchise disclosure document, or FDD, and not in the old UFOC format. There still are 23 required items, as there were previously, but there's an encouragement, for example, to disclose in item 19 earnings claims, which there wasn't before.
Right.
I'm not sure it really helps the franchisee terribly or the potential franchisee that much, because there are still a tremendous amount of disclaimers that will be attached to it, and it's going to be an average or median of the earnings reported among all of their franchisees. And so, everybody's situation is unique and different, and I know everybody as a potential franchisee wants to know, what am I going to make? But nobody can tell them that, because the reality is that where you're located, how hard you work, what are your hours, there's so many variables that can make a difference. So, but you will see more earnings claims in the documents, I think, going forward. I think the most significant change is the timing for disclosure. Right now, the timing is set up, and it's a little bit convoluted, but you had to receive the disclosure document certainly on first meeting, and that's been eliminated under the new rule. So under the new rule, you have the franchisor must provide this disclosure document 14 calendar days prior to the franchise agreement being signed or fees being paid, or earlier when requested. Now, with that said, states have not changed their regulations. So the states that have franchise laws, and there aren't that many that do, but those that do have not necessarily changed to reflect the change in the federal. So there is a little bit potential for conflict. The minimum that must be complied with is the federal. The state can have stricter rules than the federal, but it can't have broader rules.
So has the timing issue more helped the franchisor or franchisee?
Well, I think it's clarified it. It's simplified it. I don't know that it really helps the franchisee, but I think it certainly helps the franchisor in that it's easier. And the fact that you don't have to give it at a first meeting means that there's opportunities for meeting with a franchisee. Let's say I heard you talking about Discovery Day. There's opportunities to even have a Discovery Day prior to being disclosed. I don't think that's particularly helpful necessarily to the franchisee. But again, if the franchisee requests it earlier, they are required to be provided that document, and they should request it early. So that they have an opportunity. I feel very strongly that those 23 items, which are required to be written in plain English, be read over by anybody looking to buy and invest in a franchise. I always tell my clients, in particular, read over items 1 through 4, which tell you about the background of the company, litigation history, bankruptcy history of the company, the people who are involved, whether they're kind of fly-by-night people or whether they're steadily been involved in this business and this franchise for a long time. Read over items 5, 6, and 7, which will tell you about all of the fees that you're going to be paying and what your likely initial investment is going to be in those first few months of operation. I mean, those are pretty important things to know.
Right.
And maybe not, focusing on, the trademark and the patents and those kinds of things, but definitely items 1 through 7, they're going to want to read 19 if there's earnings claims in it. Look at 20 to tell you about the growth that's involved. That's changed in the new disclosure document. It's a little more detailed. There's a lot of great information there, and it's meant to be read by the potential franchisee. So definitely I think it's very important to go over that.
So overall, Nancy, a little more detailed and like maybe a little more simplified too with the language, or is that about the same?
The language was always required to be in plain English, so I think that hasn't changed that much. But I think it is it's more detailed in the information that's been provided. It's more maybe clarified a little bit in how it's presented. But you have to be careful. I mean, because again, the state laws, from a franchisor perspective, the state laws can be different. So I think, you know, any franchisors listening to this interview need to know that, you know, they need advice as well, because the changes on the federal side are one thing, but you also have to comply with the states that you're going to be registering in. So
right.
It's very important. I mean, again, it goes back to, I think it's very important to hire experienced franchise counsel, whether you're on the franchisor or franchisee side of it. You know, from the franchisee perspective, again, to have all of this explained, to have the trademark reviewed, to make sure that, you know, you're even dealing with a franchise that has a federally registered trademark. You'd be amazed how many times people come to me with relatively new franchise systems and there isn't even a trademark applied for yet. Well, the trademark is a cornerstone of what you're buying.
Right, absolutely.
And so you know, I find that very problematic. And obviously, if it's not even applied for, the risk is huge. If it is applied for but not yet registered, and it does take a year for a trademark registration, 9 months to a year for a trademark registration to be completed, there's still a huge risk there, because if that doesn't go through because of a conflicting mark from someone else and an opposition that's filed by someone else, you may find yourself in a situation of attaching yourself to a brand that then has to change.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of concerns, a lot of things that an attorney can do, even when the franchise agreement is not negotiable. And I think that's what people have to realize. You know, they come to me all the time and they go, well, but the franchisor says this document's not negotiable. Why do I need your services? Well, you still need somebody there on your team to explain to you what you're investing in. And even though the franchise fee may be $35,000 or $40,000, the investment is what is shown in item 7. You know, it can be $150,000. It could be $300,000 when all is said and done, between the cost of the lease, the cost of the build-out, and all of the other additional expenses and costs that you're going to be incurring. So it's a huge investment, and it isn't just the franchise fee that's the investment.
I mean, that's a good point, Nancy, just the fact that you can be explaining it, because it's such an intimidating document. A lot of franchise owners or first-time owners have maybe never even put together a business plan.
Exactly.
Just haven't been in business, and all of a sudden they're given this disclosure document that's, at least an inch thick. I mean, you know, it's many pages, intimidating. You know, where do I start?
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely. And I'm going to give you a real quick story if I have a moment. That is that once I had a franchise system, I represented the potential franchisee. Their document wasn't negotiable whatsoever. We always check the state records of the state in which the potential franchisee's territory will be. We check this person's state records, the state in which they were going to be located. We checked their state records and found that there was a little tiny company not related to the franchise system operating under that name in that person's territory, or to be territory. And we went back to the franchisor and said, you know, there's a potential here for a trademark action, an infringement action, because there's already a little company in his territory operating under that name in the same business, but not related to you. And the fact that in their franchise documents they would not hold their franchisees harmless for trademark infringement actions was very problematic. They agreed, even though they didn't won't change their franchise agreement, quote unquote, they agreed to an addendum covering that situation. So it's so critical to have an experienced franchise attorney reviewing the documents, and you know, we do it for a flat fee. It's well worth it.
And, I mean, it really should be mandatory, but the franchisor doesn't tell the franchisee that it's mandatory you hire an attorney.
No, because they don't want to be dealing with that.
Right.
Absolutely.
But for people listening, future franchise owners, it's, you know, one of the smartest things you can do.
And not just any attorney, a franchise attorney, because another type of attorney isn't going to understand that what types of changes can and can't be made. This is a very unique type of document. It isn't like a lease, for example,
right,
which is a heavily negotiable document. We negotiate practically every sentence in a lease when we get it. But a franchise agreement is very different. A material change to the franchise agreement can mean that they have to change their disclosure documents. So we know what can and can't be negotiated, what is a critical change, what is a critical thing to change,
right,
and what is necessary to protect our clients.
Right. It's such a big investment in a franchise. Why not make the additional investment to have total peace of mind, just make sure everything you're doing is correct.
If the franchisee is taking an SBA loan or some other type of financing, just include those fees. That's why we do it at a flat fee, so that people can anticipate what their costs are going to be up front.
Right.
And just include that in the financing that they're going to be getting.
Right. Good. So I guess changing gears a little bit, Nancy, let's talk about also your specialty in reviewing a lease. What are some legal concerns for franchisees in leasing commercial space?
Those are huge because, as I just said, the leases are extraordinarily negotiable documents, and everything in a lease is basically negotiable and negotiated. Because we do so many leases, and last year we did probably over 100 retail shopping center and mall leases.
Yeah.
Because we have certain franchise systems that we work with, and we are their recommended and authorized law firm for handling the leases for their franchisees.
Yeah.
So we just do it. Plus, we do it as, obviously, part of our relationship with our franchisee clients as well, and then any other clients that come to us that need a lease reviewed. So we do so many. Everything is up for grabs. I mean, one of the things that, for example, in any retail situation, you're going to be paying, a franchisee or a tenant is going to be paying common area maintenance charges, known as CAM charges, in addition to their basic rent. And CAM charges are to cover the areas that are, as the term sounds like, common area. So parking lot expenses, roof expenses, the common area bathrooms and hallways or walkways if it's outside, and the lighting, electricity, the maintenance to maintain, repair, to replace, any of those kinds of items. Well, we have an exhibit that we attach to every lease that we negotiate or that we review and send on to the landlord to negotiate. We attach an exhibit of 28 items that we want excluded from including in those pass-through charges to the tenant. So these charges are passed through on a prorated basis to the tenant based on the square footage percentage that tenant has in the shopping center or mall. What is included in those common area maintenance charges can vary. And so we say that things such as legal fees relating to leasing the center should not be passed through to the tenant, our client. Expenditures that are of a capital nature should not be passed through. Repairs that are caused by the landlord or by another tenant in the shopping center should not be passed through. That's just a couple examples of 28 items that we have in a list that we negotiate on our client's behalf to be excluded from including. And so that can save, on a tenant's bottom line every single month.
And when you're starting a business, your overhead is so crucial. And this is, you know, a major expense, of course, so just not what the monthly rent or lease is going to be, but, yeah, all those additional things can all add up in a hurry. So,
no question. And even things such as what are included in taxes, you know, that the rental income should not be part of the taxes that are passed through to the tenant, because most leases are what's known as triple net leases, which means that all expenses of the landlord are basically passed through. But we are very careful on what kinds of things should not be passed through. From a practical end, defining what the landlord's responsible for repairing and maintaining and what the tenant's responsible for needs to be very clearly spelled out in the lease, and often is not. The landlord should be responsible for structural repairs, But even what is defined as structural is critical to clarify.
Right.
For example, if you have pipes that come from another space into your space, is that your responsibility or the landlord's responsibility? Who shares in that if there's a problem with that? So if it says that plumbing on the interior is your responsibility, what happens to those pipes? So those have to be addressed. Tenant is typically responsible for interior repairs and maintenance, for the plate glass, for non-structural repairs, and for the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. And landlord's typically responsible for common areas and the structural repairs.
So the average person just, you know, signing a lease wouldn't think of all the details of all this. Just don't think it's going to be a problem in the future, but if it is, you know, I mean, that can really affect your business.
No question. That can cost you thousands and tens of thousands of dollars if you're responsible. One of the things we like to see is that we get a warranty that the HVAC, the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system, is in, if it's an older shopping center, that they warrant it for at least the first year, that it's in great condition. If it's
right.
new, that they pass through the warranties to the tenant. You know, these are pretty important things that can cost, as I said, tens of thousands of dollars to repair. That is very unexpected and certainly will have a major impact on your bottom line. Even something as what seems like black and white is understanding when the lease commences can be very convoluted, because rent can commence at one point, you know, and the lease can commence at another point, and just clarifying and understanding that when
right.
you need to give notice for a renewal. How much time you have for that. I'll tell you something that I consider a very, very important issue in a lease, and it's a critical issue, I think, is that if you know, often franchisors require the ability to have an assignment on the franchisee's default, for example, or the franchisee certainly wants the ability to sell the business and assign the lease. And we like to see that freedom in our leases that we have. Well, it's very, very important that the tenant, whether it's a corporation, an LLC, or an individual, we always recommend it be an entity as a corporation or a limited liability company. And if there are personal guarantees, the guarantors who are guaranteeing the lease be released upon an assignment, so that if you sell the business, let's say you buy XYZ franchise, and, you know, 3 years into the business, you have a lease, and 3 years into the business, you've done so phenomenally well that you've decided you want to retire and go to, you know, Florida or Southern California and live your life out on the beach. And you sell the business, you find somebody to buy it for a phenomenal price, and just, you know, you're in great shape, you want to sign the lease. The last thing you want is to, a year later, be called back to pay rent and be responsible for repairs and other obligations under the lease because the person that you sold to has defaulted. So it's very critical that you be released, and you as both the entity and individually be released upon assignment if the business is sold or if it is assigned for any other reason.
Yeah, that's a great point. Even the seller having the flexibility that the new owner can come in and still have that lease, because that might be one of the main selling points of that they have a great location and a real good lease.
That's a huge asset. I mean, we do a lot of acquisitions and sales of businesses, both franchise and non-franchise businesses, and,
yeah.
You know, that's a huge asset to any business. When you're acquiring a business, you're acquiring also the lease for that location if you want that.
Right.
Usually the buyer determines whether they want it or not, but if there's three years into a lease that's a 5-year lease, the seller is certainly not going to sell a business without being able to get out of the lease or sell that as an asset.
Right.
So it's definitely an important consideration.
Yeah, you know, so the bottom line is you make sure you have a specialist like yourself review the lease, and I would think during these times, you know, doesn't the franchisee have a little bit of the advantage with the way the economy is? Or
I'm not seeing that so much with rental. I mean, certainly I think you're right in the housing market. It is a buyer's market, but I'm really not seeing it as much in leases. Commercial leases are a different breed altogether anyway. I mean, the rights of a landlord in a commercial lease are very different, for example, than in a residential lease. We don't handle any residential matters. We're a business law firm, but you know, when I see the rights of a commercial landlord are just much greater than any residential situation.
Right.
I wanted to point out, if I may, just a couple other really key things that I think any particular, any potential franchisee tenant should be thinking about, if I
yeah.
have a moment.
Sure.
You know, one, you want to make sure that the use provision in the lease is broad enough to encompass what you plan on selling down the road. I mean, your franchisor may tell you to start selling, you know, you may be in the food business, and let's say you're a McDonald's franchisee. You know, what if in a couple of years McDonald's says to start selling McDonald's T-shirts or little Ronald McDonald dolls? Do you have the right to do that? And I think that's an important thing. And do you have an exclusive use in your shopping center or mall? I mean, can they put in, you know, five other burger places in the same location and compete with you? You want to make sure that if you need government permits for your location, that if you can't get them, that you have a right to terminate your lease, because otherwise, you know, what are you going to do? If the governmental local agent, local governing authority won't give you a permit, how are you going to operate? How are you going to open? So you need to
right.
be able to have that right. You want to make sure that the landlord provides warranties for both the Americans with Disability Act compliance, that the parking lot has enough handicapped spaces, that the curb cuts are in compliance, that your premises, that the door is wide enough for a wheelchair to come in, that any bathrooms are handicap accessible, that the center and the premises are in compliance with the hazardous substances laws, and that any indemnification, meaning any hold harmless, that the landlord is asking of you is a very narrow one. All of these are very important, that you're given enough notice and an opportunity to fix or cure any default. If you are in default, if you're just late in making a payment, or if you're in a non-monetary default, what are your rights and what are the landlord's remedies? How horrible are they? Because they can be very horrible. They can have a security interest on your assets. In a lot of leases, I see that, in which they have a right to come in and sell your personal property.
It's really amazing. You're right. Just really anything could be negotiated with. But that's pretty interesting. You're saying sometimes, if say someone is going to open up a Haagen-Dazs or an ice cream franchise, it can be agreed in the lease that that whole mall location can't, say, have another three ice cream places?
Happens all the time.
Wow.
All the time. And, in fact, not only that, but if there's, let's say, Starbucks in that shopping center, very well might be that ice cream franchise coming in is going to be restricted and not be allowed to sell coffee-flavored ice cream. And you have to work that out.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, you have to be very careful on the use provisions and exclusive use clauses. But, yeah, it's a wonderful clause if you can get it in your favor, but it's also other tenants in that center may have them that you have to be careful of. So it works both ways, that you have to be very careful.
Right.
Interesting. It was an interesting story, Nancy, with, I guess, Dunkin' Donuts franchisees. Some of them were upset because, I don't know if you've noticed, but Dunkin' Donuts is starting to sell their coffee in the supermarket. So I understood that some of their franchisees were also upset about that, and they said there's something you know better than I about this. I guess it's called a cannibalization clause. Is that what they call it? Or, you know, just
in which the franchise, in the franchise agreements, in which the franchisor, you know, typically in most franchise agreements, the franchisor has the right to sell through alternative
right.
Sources or alternative ways, through the internet or through
right.
Other markets that aren't the typical retail market, like a Haagen-Dazs might be a little local business,
right.
They have the opportunity to maybe sell and open up on their own in other types of venues in their territory. And, yeah, okay, it has caused problems. Carvel had big issues with that.
Right.
One other thing I want to mention again with the lease, because there is so much,
right.
is if you do have to give a yeah. personal guarantee, there are ways to limit it. And I just, that's probably the last thing I need to mention, but you know, that and relocating within in this shopping center, the landlord's right to do that, again, is something that the landlord likes to see, because the landlord wants to be able to move you around if they've got a bigger tenant that wants
right.
to come in, or they're going to do renovations or what have you. And from a franchisee's perspective, obviously your accessibility and visibility are critical, and so you don't want to be moved. So that's, you know.
And then who would pick up the cost of the move?
A big issue.
Yeah.
Lots of times what we do is we try to negotiate that the landlord can only move you to certain places that we feel are just as good from a visibility, accessibility perspective, and that they pay for everything, the moving costs, stationery, phone, everything. And, you know.
Right. You're not having that control on your business is very scary. It's worth all the money in the world to have someone like yourself go over all the fine points. So, you know, something can't disrupt your business when things are going well. Like you're right. You might have a part of the mall where people have known you're there for years and you go there. If you get up and move, that can really affect your business and can quickly be a downward spiral. So,
no question. And even the timing of it, I mean, think about this. If you were a retail business that counted on the Christmas season, obviously you would never want to be relocated during that season and be down during your critical season, which you may be in 2 or 3 months period of time make your entire year's revenue.
Right.
Or if you were a Häagen-Dazs, you certainly, you know, in the Northeast corridor would not want to be, you know, down in the summer season. So, you know, it's very critical that you have someone on your team through this whole process, you know, through the franchise documents all the way through to helping you with your employees. And, you know, we're here to do that, to be on your team.
Yeah, this is really a topic that we can spend, I mean, at least a few more hours discussing.
Definitely. I have lots more I could be saying.
So we're talking about the FDD, leasing and so forth. Any other tips? I mean, obviously, Nancy, you're an expert. Anything else that the franchisee should be concerned about when investing in a franchise? Just other issues?
There's more than the lease. I mean, you want to make sure that the insurance provisions are reasonable. You want to make sure that you have the right to alter. That's another issue where the franchisor could tell you that we've decided we want a new color scheme. We want you to put a new carpet. Let's say that they want you to put in, renovate every 3 years or every 5 years. Does the landlord allow that? Or do you have to go get the landlord's consent? And what happens if the landlord doesn't approve what the franchisor is requiring of you? You could be in default under the franchise agreement or default under the lease, and they could be conflicting provisions. So
that's interesting. A lot of things on the franchisor, so I can then get you back to the lease situation and landlord.
It's a very touchy situation. It's very important, and that's why as a franchise attorney who also does so many leases and leasing attorney, we, you know, as a firm, have everybody's focus and understanding in mind when we're going through these documents.
Yes, we have about 60 seconds. What's the best way for someone to get more information on your services?
They can always call me. My number is 215-525-1165. I'm extension 1. Or alternatively, they certainly can find out information on my website, which is www.lenardlaw.com. That's all A's. And in the it's LENARDLAW.com. And there's lots of articles and information that's available on the website, as well as a link to that Costco article that you mentioned at the beginning.
That's a great article. You and Marty have the Pennsylvania connection going.
Yes, we do.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful day today, isn't it, Nancy?
It is a gorgeous day today. I'm
sure.
Thrilled. Everything's in bloom. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, and I want to thank you again, Nancy. You're always a fantastic guest, and I think Don and I are both in agreement that we have to have you back because there's just so much more to talk about.
It's a lot of fun. I enjoy it, and I'm happy to do it any time. I've really had a good time.
Great.
You helped so
much,
many people today, Nancy. Thanks for your great advice.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you guys again to do this again and to your listeners to help them out.
Absolutely.
Thanks great.
So much again, Nancy. You have a great day today.
Take care, Nancy.
Bye-bye.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Very informative, huh, Don?
Yeah.
It's just so many variables involved. I mean, as you said, I mean, it really could have been a 2-3-hour show. You know?
Yeah, you're starting a business, whether it's a business or a franchise. I mean, there's a lot on the line. There's a lot you have to go over, and you have to have a specialist. I mean, you have to have someone who's in your corner looking at all these details because you don't want to make any mistakes on anything related to all the startup process.
Sure, absolutely. And we also, we actually had questions coming in from the chat room as well that I just couldn't get to, So for the people in the chat room today, again, sorry we couldn't get to your questions, but actually one of the questions, Don, if you want to try giving it a shot, was from Michael. He was asking if he thinks it's a benefit of being a franchisor or being part of the IFA. Now, I know you guys, Diamond Financial, you're part of the IFA, aren't you?
Yes, yeah, I feel it's important. So he's a franchisor. There's certainly a lot of benefits. I mean, you can go to the website and so forth. It's just, it just seems like when people and companies see that you're a member of the IFA, it just gives, you know, it just builds to your reputation a little bit. There's a lot of benefits. Even when you exhibit at the trade shows, you get a discount off the show. And, I'm definitely a proponent of being a member of the IFA.
Okay, that's great. Well, I want to thank you again, Don. You did a great job today. And, again, thank Nancy for being a guest. And, again, we're going to have her back on a future show.
Definitely.
And,
of course, this interview will be archived. And see all the interviews on franchiseinterviews.com. You can go to gofranchise.com, our show page, adding to the library, right?
And there we go. So you have a great day, Don. I'll talk to you again next week.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And today's guest is Kevin Hines, who is one of the top franchise attorneys and experts in the country. And Kevin is a partner with the Denver office of Snell and Wilmer LLP, where he co-chairs the firm's retail and franchise services practices group. Kevin's also a founding chairman of the Colorado Bar Association subsection on franchise law, and also served from 1998 to 2001 as the Young Lawyers Division liaison to the ABA Forum on Franchise Law. Good morning, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today, Kevin?
Excellent.
Great. Kevin, joining us is my co-host. I think you know Don Johnson, president of Diamond Financial Services, and I know, Don, you wanted to say hi to Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin, thanks a lot for your time today. We're really looking forward to discussing franchising, all your years of experience in the industry, and it was nice seeing you at the show a couple months ago, meeting you, of course.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
It seems like yesterday, doesn't it, Kevin, that we were in Washington? It just goes by so fast, doesn't it?
It is amazing. I can't believe we're almost at the end of May.
It's crazy. Okay. It really does, you know. Kevin, since starting the radio show, Don and I have had some really interesting concepts on this show. From your experience, what makes a concept franchisable?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I think in my experience, and certainly we've worked with a significant number of emerging concepts, there are really probably four key elements that any business that is looking at franchising probably needs to consider. And the first, and I think the most important without question, is what I call unit economics. Unit economics really goes to how much the individuals, whether it's a store or business concept that's run out of somebody's home, how much the individual franchisee can make. And that is particularly important compared to the investment that the franchisee needs to make to get the business started. And I always tell clients when we're talking about franchising a new concept that you need to make sure that the business at the unit level can do three things. Number one, it has to be able to generate enough revenue, obviously, to cover its expenses.
Right.
The second is it needs to be able to generate enough revenue to cover a reasonable salary for the franchise owner or a manager that is in running the business. And the third thing is that it needs to give the franchisee a return on the investment. So if the franchisee is going to spend $200,000 to get the business up and running, there needs to be enough excess cash to give that person a return that's comparable or better than what that person could earn if you put that money into the stock market or some other kind of investment format.
Right, absolutely.
I think the second element has to be a reasonable demand for the product that you're serving. Sometimes people find such unique niches that when they try and expand out of a particular marketplace or a city or a geographic area, they find that there isn't significant demand for the product. It's not universally accepted. Sometimes you can overcome that by educating the population about your product, but that's a very expensive and time-consuming endeavor.
Sure.
And I always tell the story about a concept called Cincinnati Chili, or a product called Cincinnati Chili. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to eat Cincinnati-style chili, but it's a very different chili than most of the country is familiar with. It's very popular in the upper Midwest part of the country. And years ago, I worked with a gentleman who had bought the regional rights for Colorado for Cincinnati Chili. And his plan was to open 20 or 30 different restaurants. Well, he was never able to get a single one open because people in Colorado just don't eat Cincinnati-style chili. So you really want to make sure before you try and roll something out on a grand scale that there's a real interest in your product.
Right, absolutely. That's interesting.
The third thing...
So how would you do that, Kevin? I guess there's outside companies. I guess that's...
Absolutely. I think if you're in certain kinds of businesses, there's a built-in demand. For example, if you're in the pizza business, that people eat pizza all over the country. So that may not be such a challenge. But if you really have a unique product or a unique service, it probably pays to engage one of the great franchise consulting firms around the country to go in and do some kind of a market analysis for you.
Right. Absolutely.
The third thing I think that people need to focus on is whether or not they can easily replicate their system. The more difficult, the more detailed the operation is, the harder it is to replicate. So, for example, take the food industry. You see lots and lots of franchise companies in the quick service restaurant segment, in the fashion casual segment, but you see very few successful franchise companies in the fine dining or the white tablecloth segment.
Sure.
And the reason is that it's very difficult to teach other people to execute at that level. When you've got people coming in at a very high price point, they don't want just food, they want a good experience, and that requires a certain level of skill and expertise, and it's very hard to replicate that across restaurants, even in a single city, much less across the country. So you want to make sure that you have something that's pretty easy to replicate and that you can train people on, because frankly, you want people to, you want your franchisees to come in and be able to duplicate what you've done, or you're not going to build a very successful franchise system.
Right. I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons people invest in a franchise, of course, the money aspect, but because of this, the simplicity, hopefully, that the franchisor puts together. So this is a big part of you know, what you're talking about here, Kevin.
Absolutely. And the hallmark of franchising, and I know that some people can be critical of this, but the hallmark of franchising is that you give people the same experience no matter what market they're in.
Exactly.
You know, and we all know that if we stop at a McDonald's, whether we're in Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine, that hamburger is going to be the same.
Right.
And it's the same experience, and people come to rely on that and count on that experience, and that's why franchising has been so successful in so many industries.
Absolutely.
You know, and the last thing I always tell people is that you better have a unique marketing proposition. If you're going to try and franchise something and it's already been done, then you're at a real disadvantage. If you're just going to roll out the next hamburger chain franchise, and there's nothing unique about what you do, then people are not going to be interested in buying into your system. They want to know, how do I compete with McDonald's, not how do I stand out there as a me too in comparison to McDonald's. So whether it's a new way of providing the service, whether it's a new way of collecting money, whether it's a new gimmick in terms of getting people in the door. I think of Pizza Patron, for example, the pizza chain out of Texas that serves predominantly the Latino market that recently started to accept pesos.
Right.
And I mean, that's a great marketing proposition. It's a way to say, look, yeah, we sell pizza, but boy, is this ever, you know, a unique way to get people in the door, people who have different currencies and who have different issues. You know, we're gonna service that market. That's something unique. And that's what makes, that's one of the things that makes that chain particularly unique, and therefore is able to attract people to become prospective franchisees.
Yeah, that pizza chain got a lot of PR too, Kevin, from that whole thing. You know, by doing something different, you know, it was they were pretty much in every national newspaper across the United States.
Yeah,
right. Well, you know,
there's
the old saying that, you know, good PR or bad PR is the same. It's going to drive people in the door.
Right.
Yeah, wasn't that your idea, Kevin, that accepting pesos?
I would love to say that was my idea, but I'm not quite
that
creative.
You know, you brought up a good point about the uniqueness here. I mean, we I don't know if you listened earlier, but last week we interviewed Badass Coffee, and, you know, there's a lot of different coffee franchises, but they stand out because they're quality coffee. They have a Hawaiian theme.
Right.
They have a whole story behind it. It was why they're having success, Kevin, is this point you're bringing up about the unique marketing, you know, proposition.
Right, that's what I thought of, Don, as Kevin was explaining this. I thought of the same thing, Badass Coffee.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's a great example. There's lots of coffee purveyors out there.
Right.
What's the hook? What's the hook to get people to buy the franchise? And more importantly, what's the hook to get new customers in the door?
Exactly.
Right. Kevin, after it's determined that a concept is franchisable, then what's the next step?
Well, I think the next most important step is to put together a really solid business plan. You know, it's one thing to say, gee, I think I've met the criteria. It's another thing to say, now I know how to implement it. Because
right.
As I always tell people, when you transition from being an operator of a chain of, you name it, XYZ stores selling widgets, you're in a different business model, and we always tell people, you're no longer in the hamburger business, you're now in the franchise business. You're no longer in the drugstore business, you're in the franchise business, and that requires a whole different set of plans. It requires a whole different set of implementation skills. And frankly, it's going to require bringing on people that do things for your franchisees that you're not probably currently doing for your company-owned stores.
Right. There's definitely two different animals, Kevin, as you say.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's something. Interesting. Is there a particular format for a business plan that people need to adhere to, Kevin?
No, there really is not one particular format. I wish that there was one magic business plan that I could send people to.
Right.
But really, a business plan is nothing more than putting a person's thoughts on paper in an organized manner.
Right.
And so there's lots and lots of different ways to do it, and frankly, there's some good software out there. There are lots of books that will guide you on how to prepare a business plan. It's not like preparing an offering circular with 23 items and you follow the format and everybody has the same-looking offering circular. This is something truly that's going to be unique to each business, and it really needs to be workable. It needs to be workable not only for the business owner to sort of lay out his or her thoughts and ideas, but ultimately other people are going to need to see it too. If you're going to look for financing, your banker's probably going to want to see it. If you're going to look for investors, your investors are going to want to see it. If you're going to prepare franchise documents, the attorney you're working with would find it really helpful in order to prepare those documents. So it becomes a multi-purpose document, and it just needs to work.
Right, absolutely.
We tell people, Kevin, really just to keep it simple, myself being in the franchise financing business, it scares people.
Absolutely.
Business plan. They're thinking because they're investing in a franchise that they'll get all that from the franchisor, but like you said, they have to have their own goals, and it's really unique to them. And, we give people an outline. We tell them this is something that you're, it's just not for financing and getting a loan. This is for your own.
Right.
To review your own goals. It's a must.
Well, and I think a good business plan is just critical to any business person. We actually have a form here at my law firm that we have attorneys fill out every year it's pretty simple. It's a two-pager, but it really helps people stay focused on the business development aspect of being a lawyer. And I think any business owner probably should have a business plan and should have it in writing. Most people say, I've got it and it's in my head.
Right, right.
But when you're transitioning to something like a franchise, you really need to put it on paper.
Absolutely. Do you recommend that the business owner write it themselves, Kevin? I mean, I know there's a lot of services out there where you can hire somebody to write the business plan for you, which I'm kind of against. I think a business plan kind of forces you to go through all the different scenarios that can occur. Do you suggest that they do write the business plan themselves?
I think the first crack of the business plan should definitely be done by the business owner.
Right.
If you're looking to raise capital, you may want to professionalize the business plan after you put your thoughts on paper. You may want to hire somebody to turn your written product into something that you can take out to the investment community or the financing community. And that may make sense. But nobody is going to understand your business like you do. And so if you hire somebody, some third party to write your business plan, that person's probably going to miss a lot of stuff.
I agree, absolutely. Interesting.
Kevin, are there any resources to help people through the business plan creation? I guess we've maybe touched on this a little bit.
Yeah, there are sections in your local bookstore. Go to Barnes & Noble or go to your local library in the business section, and you'll find book after book on business plans. There's also some good software programs out there that will help you. They basically go through and they prompt you with questions. Okay, think about this, think about that, and they oftentimes have tables in them that will allow you to actually plug in numbers.
Right.
And
right.
So if you're really going to do something that requires some financial planning, probably makes sense to invest, $100 or $200 and buy some of that software that's out there.
I agree.
That's always a big question with the business plan. When our lenders are reviewing a loan package, they're always reviewing the projections that people have to do for a couple of years. And, lenders don't want to see that a red flag can be raised if people feel they might be making too much money the first couple of years, or their goals are set too high. So you always have to find that fine line. You don't want to make it too low with their sales and profit, or too high. What's your feeling on that, Kevin?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, to me, the big issue, and certainly we see this time and time again, is whatever your projections are, assume you're going to only hit half of them, and make sure you have sufficient working capital so that you can ride out the rough times.
Right.
To go back to the point of starting a new franchise system, you know, a lot of times franchisors, rightly or wrongly, come in pretty thinly capital dependent on those initial franchise sales. And the risk is, if you're overly dependent on that, that you make bad choices simply because people can write a check. And
right.
You certainly don't want to start your system with the wrong franchisees merely because you need the capital to keep the doors open.
Interesting.
Yeah, I see a lot of franchisees doing that, just wanting to add numbers, not really, you know, many of the loans we do, Kevin, are startup loans, so we see a lot of people who just don't have that cash reserve. You maybe have enough to pay the franchise fee and maybe have a little equity in their home, and we always make sure we include working capital in the financing with the lenders we work with, but we see a lot of people who really shouldn't have been referred to us in the first place. Even though there's working capital alone, if that new franchisee starts to struggle a little bit, there's not much for them to fall back on. The franchisor is not really, you know, giving that franchisee the, you know, the best chance in the world. You should always plan for worst case and have that reserve. You know, I guess the better franchisors set their criteria higher for
right,
you know,
right. And I think, right. You know, certainly the successful ones that I've worked with have, you know, pretty high net worth requirements. Have substantial capital requirements, have substantial cash requirements.
Experience.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Don, but I think a typical SBA loan will probably finance up to 80% of the total project cost.
Right, and that's 75 to 80 range,
okay.
Right, for a start.
But, you know, it's a heck of a lot safer for both the franchisor and the franchisee if you're financing something more like 50% of the cost.
Right.
And you have that much additional cash available in the event things don't turn out the way that you think they are. You know, and we have unforeseen events happen all the time. I mean, think about all the franchisees that opened in New Orleans in the first and second quarter of 2005. They could never have seen
right
what was going to happen there. And you really just have to plan. You have to be able to plan for the unexpected.
And have something like outside income. You know, lenders like it when there's where the franchisee is not going to be dependent on income from that new franchise to pay their personal expenses. Another spouse is working, or they have a good chunk saved up in retirement, or even be able to use some of that retirement money to roll over toward the down payment on a franchise and hold on to a lot of their other cash. Different options. It's all the stuff we look at. I mean, you're right. You can never know what will happen. So you got to plan really on, whereas with a lot of franchises, you do make money the first year, but really plan on not making money the first year.
Right, and that actually sort of takes me to another point, which is, you know, some franchises are really merely job replacement franchises. I mean, if all you're doing is effectively buying a job, then the matrix is different than if you're really doing this because you're trying to take control of your life and you want to make not just a sound financial decision from a day-to-day pay perspective, but also an investment decision. And, you know, I think there are too many people who simply say, you know, I'm done with the workforce. I'm going to, you know, control my own destiny. And they get themselves into these franchises where they're not making much more than they would otherwise have made, and they become slaves to the business. And the worst is they become very dependent early on that income. And if they're not making the kind of margins they think that they're going to make early on, they really can struggle.
And it's a trickle-down effect, because then they are not as happy, and if you're not happy and have that positive attitude, it's going to show in the business. So
that's correct.
And
they don't validate well for the rest of the franchise system.
Right.
Absolutely. Kevin, are you able to stick around for another segment?
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Log Talk Radio.
And today's guest is Kevin Hine, who is one of the top franchise attorneys and experts in the country. And Kevin is a partner with the Denver office of Snell & Wilmer LLP, where he co-chairs the firm's retail and franchise services practice group. And Don, I think I'm up. Kevin, in addition to the business plan that we were just talking about, what are the mandatory documents that one must create in order to offer and sell franchises?
Sure. Couple of things. First of all, in order to sell a franchise or offer a franchise anywhere in the United States, a franchise system has to have what's called a Uniform Franchise Offering Circular. That's a document, and it's a disclosure document. It's designed to inform a prospective franchisee about anything in prospect, not anything, let me back up, about certain information that the FTC has decided and various registration states have decided are critical pieces of information in order to make the franchisee knowledgeable about making the investment.
Right.
The document, as I mentioned in the last segment, is the same format regardless of the industry. So there's 23 items that every franchisor must discuss, and it covers everything from who's the franchisor, who are the key officers and directors, what's the investment, what are the franchisee's responsibilities, what are the franchisor's responsibilities, how many franchises are in the system, etc. The document also contains a copy of every agreement that the prospective franchisee could be required to sign at the beginning of the relationship. So it can be pretty thick. You know, some systems are so big and so developed that they look like small telephone books.
Right.
And, you know, it's a very, for most people, I think it's an intimidating document, but it's a really critical document for prospective franchisees to read and give careful consideration to.
Right.
And then
the
second thing
that ever happened, you know, in the industry, Kevin, you know, is having this UFOC. I don't know if you heard the first segment. We talked about the last 30 years, a little bit of history, an article on Entrepreneur, and all this regulation, things like the UFOC, is really what made franchising so successful.
Oh, I think that that's absolutely correct. I did hear part of your segment, and I think when you look at the scams that happened in the 50s and 60s where people literally were selling franchise concepts that didn't exist.
Right.
But they were really good salespeople, and there was no disclosure requirement. There was nothing. So, you know, a silver-tongued salesman could sell anything. There's a great story about Minnie Pearl and the infamous Minnie Pearl chicken franchise. Most people know Minnie Pearl or recall her from her days with Grand Ole Opry.
Right.
And somebody went out and invented, literally invented, a chicken franchise concept that supposedly she was affiliated with. And they were out there selling it, and she knew nothing about it. And literally they were taking people's investment dollars and disappearing into the night. And that really led to franchise regulation. The first law was passed in California in, I think, 1972. The Federal Trade Commission's law became effective in 1979. But as Don, you had mentioned in some of the stuff you were reading, the history of franchising has, I think, in the last 30 years been saved largely because of these disclosure requirements.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Should one consult a franchise attorney, Kevin? You know, as you said, you know, some of these documents, these UFOCs, you know, could be quite intimidating. You know, they're supposed to be written in layman's terms, but, you know, when you see something, as you say, like a telephone directory, I guess it could be quite overwhelming for somebody. Should someone consult a franchise attorney?
Absolutely. If somebody is looking to invest in a franchise of any kind, one of the best ways they can spend dollars is to consult a franchise attorney. And again, it needs to be a franchise attorney, and that's for a couple of reasons.
Right.
First of all, they don't want to spend a lot of money with somebody who doesn't understand franchising, because somebody who doesn't understand franchising is going to look at these documents and say, wow, this is crazy. I'd never do this. These documents are very one-sided, and by definition, they are. They're very franchisor-friendly.
Right.
But I will tell you that if you're a franchisee in a system and you're a good operator and you follow the rules, those documents are your best friends, because those documents allow the franchisor to take care of the troubling franchisees. But if you bring these documents to somebody who's not a franchise attorney, they're either going to potentially dissuade you from purchasing a franchise because they think the documents are unfair, or they're going to spend a lot of time trying to mark them up and get them changed. And, you know, the bottom line is, if you're buying a single-unit franchise, you have virtually no negotiating power, even with a small and emerging franchise company. And so you could spend a lot of your very scarce resources paying an attorney to mark up a document that's not going to get you anywhere. And that's why you want to go to somebody who understands franchising, will use your money wisely, will inform you of the risks and anything that may be odd or unusual about the particular franchise system you're looking at, but isn't going to try and rewrite the document on your nickel.
Absolutely.
That's a good point you made,
yeah.
Kevin, how even though it's pro-franchise UFOC, but overall it protects that franchisee, you know, with other potential franchisees coming into the system. So, you know, there is a lot of protection for you, you know, thinking from that aspect.
Right. Absolutely.
And besides UFOC, you're having someone like yourself hiring your services, there's the review of the franchise agreement, And what are some of the other things that you can do for a franchisee?
Oh, that a franchise attorney can do?
Right.
The first thing you want to do is have the franchise attorney review the offering circular and the franchise agreement. And like I said, you want them really to focus on anything that's unusual, particularly onerous, or kind of out of the box. And those are the things that you may be able to go back to a franchisor and say, gee, this is really unusual, this royalty is way out of line with everything else, or gee, I've never seen this kind of a fee before, is there a way we can work with it? Oftentimes, the franchisor is going to say this is the program, take it or leave it. But at least if you go in with your eyes open, you know what you're getting yourself into.
Right.
The other thing that a good franchise lawyer can help you with is to incorporate the business you're going to operate the franchise under. If you're taking retail space, that lawyer should be able to help you negotiate a lease. You're going to have employment issues in most franchise systems. Hopefully the lawyer either has the ability, him or herself, to give you some guidance on employment, or at least is in a firm that has an employment lawyer, so that when you start hiring employees and you bring people on board, if you have questions, you can get them answered. You know, you want to look for somebody who comes from, has enough of a background or is with a large enough firm that you can get full service because, you know, as a business owner, you face all kinds of issues. You know,
right.
In addition to employment, you're going to have tax questions. You're going to have real estate questions. You might have questions that relate to, I don't know, an encroachment. You know, somebody's encroaching on the piece of property that you own, you know.
Right.
And so you want to work with a firm that, although you don't necessarily want to have to go to them all the time because that can get expensive, you want to know you've got access to people that can answer your questions quickly and efficiently.
Exactly. What else should one focus on, Kevin, when starting a franchise system?
Well, the other thing that's going to be critical is documenting those procedures that we talked about in an operations manual.
Right.
You know, we talked about the ease of replicating the system as being a critical component. Well, you not only have to be able to do it, but you have to be able to write it down and let other people know how to do it as well. And, you know, I've had clients come over the years who said, well, gee, I've got this binder of notes and scraps of paper and everything else. I'm just going to kind of organize it and make that my operations manual. And I always tell them it makes sense. It will be a good investment if you either take the time yourself to really write the operations manual or hire it out. There are great companies out there that can write operations manuals because that manual is what really saves you from a lot of grief and heartache with your franchisees. If
right.
you've written it down and franchisees are getting up and running and they can go to the book and figure out how to do something, they're less likely to call you. If they don't know how to do it and they can't get access to it, then they're going to be on the phone to you all the time. And
right.
if you're trying to sell franchises, you don't want to spend a ton of time also having to worry about supporting your ongoing franchisees with easy day-to-day kinds of questions. And that's why an operations manual is absolutely critical.
And that must take a long time to write, too, I imagine, too, Kevin. You know, documenting it, you know, from, I guess, you know, starting from turning the lights on in the morning till going home at the end of the night. You know,
absolutely.
I guess there's so
absolutely.
Many variables
I mean,
involved.
You know, when it comes to making a hamburger, you literally say, you know, get out the hamburger meat.
Right, exactly.
Get out the bun.
Step by step.
And you know, the operations manual doesn't just include step-by-step instructions. It includes everything from your supplier list, like who do I buy the hamburger meat from?
Right.
Who do I buy the hamburger bun from? To, you know, insurance requirements, to other operating requirements that may not impact necessarily what the franchisee does day-to-day, but overall tells the franchisee how to operate the business. And that's the other thing that franchisors need to remember is that most franchisees are not sophisticated business people who have experience operating their own businesses.
Right.
Even if they attract people who've spent time in middle and senior management for big corporations, those people don't know what it's like to literally start a business from scratch, from incorporating it to setting up the accounting to getting the licenses and permits. And so the operations and ad manual really needs to assume that you're starting every single time with franchisees who know absolutely nothing about
right.
not only the business that they're buying, but business in general.
Interesting.
Good point. So, Kevin, these are probably pretty busy days for you, you know, you and your office, with just the growth of the franchise industry. I mean, imagine you just have work, you know, work galore, right?
It is absolutely amazing. We're very blessed. We represent over 100 different franchise brands, and one of the areas that we think excel in here at this firm is working with emerging franchise companies The last 2 years, we rolled out more than a dozen new systems each year, and this year we're on pace to do something more like 18 to 20.
Wow.
And you mentioned, again, Don, in the first segment that I think Entrepreneur Magazine said something like 900 new franchise systems have been created in the last year. We see lots and lots of great little niche concepts that are coming to the marketplace and coming to us and coming to other franchise firms to really get themselves out and into the marketplace.
Yeah,
I see it as well on financing. So many of the, you know, Marty and I talk about this a lot on the show, is all these little niche franchises. It'll be interesting to see where they go over the next few years.
Right.
All these concepts that started from, you know, eBay, and, you know, we mentioned coffee, and, I mean, there's so many niche markets. It's really amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim, we have about 30 seconds. What's the best way for someone to get in touch with you? Website, phone number?
Website at www.swlaw.com or my phone number, 303-634-2015.
And I want to thank you again, Kevin. It was great to talk to you again, and we're definitely going to have you back because I think there's more to talk about.
Listen, I'd love the opportunity. Thanks so much, guys. Have a great
day. Thanks, Kevin. You have
thank
a great Memorial Day weekend.
All right, you too.
Take care.
Right,
thanks. Take care, Kevin.
Bye.
Another great show, huh, Don?
Yeah.
Very informative. I mean, it's just there's so much more to talk about, though.
He's one of the tops in his field.
He really is. I mean, he really knows his stuff, you know, so it was a pleasure having him. So anyway, I want to wish you a happy Memorial Day weekend, Don. Great job today. And for our listeners, go to franchiseinterviews.com. And again, we have about 30 shows you can listen to in the archives. So thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Franchise Interviews on Blog Talk Radio on this Sunday, March 16th. Today you're going to get to hear a fantastic interview we did last year with franchise attorney Nancy Lenard, and Nancy discusses some of the common pitfalls aspiring entrepreneurs can run into if they don't hire a franchise attorney. And this is part one of a two-segment interview. So enjoy, and we'll see you again later for another show. Take care.
Attorney, and Nancy's been helping businesses grow for more than 25 years. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm good today, Nancy. Nancy, joining us is my co-host, Don Johnson, and he's also the president of Diamond Financial. And I know you wanted to say hi, Don, to Nancy.
Yeah, hi, Nancy. Thanks for coming on the show. I just wanted to mention I have a couple attorneys in my family. Brevin Law, who's a corporate attorney for a telecommunications company. I got an uncle down in Louisiana. Owns his own practice but they're both probably not as good as you, though.
Sounds like you're well covered there, Don.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Nancy, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. You know, Don and I were saying earlier that, you know, this is one of the most important shows because the role a franchise attorney plays is such an important part of buying a franchise. Can you tell our listening audience why it's important for a prospective franchisee to hire a franchise attorney?
Yeah, that's a great question because there are many people who don't do that, who decide to use one of their relatives, like your family members,
right,
or who decide not to use an attorney at all to review their documents. And they're making a huge mistake because they don't have someone on their side who is their teammate through the process, who can hold their hand and explain the process to them, explain these complex legal documents they will be handed. They're going to be handed documents that are the Uniform Franchise Offering Circular, the UFOC, which is a big, thick document that has all kinds of valuable information in it that they will need to evaluate and understand. In addition, it's a very unique area of the law, and general business attorneys, as well as certainly other types of attorneys, divorce and personal injury, and tax attorneys, estate attorneys, aren't going to have an understanding of what this document is and what it means to the individual who's looking to buy a franchise. We pride ourselves in addition to being knowledgeable about this area of law and having a strong focus on this area of law, we pride ourselves also on trying to help the client achieve their goals. And we are deal makers. We're not deal breakers. We try very hard to come up with a creative way to resolve any concerns and red flags that appear in any of the documents.
Right.
But we, because of our
background and our experience in this area, we know what are typical provisions and what aren't. And so we can advise the client, whereas somebody who is coming in looking at these contracts, looking at the UFOC, who has not the background in this area, would not understand what is typical, what can be negotiated, what can't, what is reasonable to ask for, and what are some of the red flags that do need to be addressed and are of concern.
Right, absolutely. That's interesting. I just heard a story recently, Nancy, of a franchisee that was having some location problems, and the attorney that they hired initially had little, there's no experience in franchising. So, you know, absolutely, some of these problems can certainly be eliminated up front by hiring a franchise attorney.
And one of the things, Marty, that we do is we advise even before the client comes to us, we tell the client up front there's certain due diligence that they need to pursue before they ever make the decision to narrow down to this particular franchise and come to have us review the documents. And some of that due diligence is, for example, talking to franchisees that are in the system and finding out about the support and the training that they receive. I mean, I think typically franchisees or potential franchisees, they ask questions about the financial situation, you know, how much money are they going to make. But they need to also ask about the support and the training that they receive from the franchisor. Also identified in that UFOC, that offering circular, are franchisees who have left the system, and they are a valuable resource to find out exactly why they left. I mean, many of them have left the system because they may be retiring or they may have health issues, but many of them have experienced some issues with the franchisor that they might be willing to discuss, and that's important to find out as well. You know, what did they like and dislike about the support and training they received? And lastly, we recommend that people take the financials that are in the UFOC. There are audited financials of the franchisor required to be in the document, and we recommend that they take those financials to an experienced accountant who has a background in franchising as well. And we have some names that we can provide to people, and that these financials be reviewed from a couple different perspectives, that they're reviewed from the perspective of is a franchisor in a financial position to support the system that they have set up? In other words, is the franchisor financially strong enough to support the system that exists and the system that they anticipate, the growth that they are looking to have, all of which can be discerned from the UFOC itself. And the second review that the accountant should perform is a typical accounting review, which is given all of the fees, the royalties, the advertising fees, and other fees that the franchisee will be paying, at what point would the franchisee be able to be making money and be in the black? So those are the types of things that we would suggest that a client of ours do even before they actually have us start to review the documents.
Yeah, and I think the UFOC is one of the best things, I guess, that ever happened to franchising, Nancy, you know?
Yeah, and just to explain, really, because I don't know that the audience even necessarily understands what the UFOC contains.
Okay.
It is actually a big bound volume that comes out of the securities laws. So it's similar, if anybody's ever bought stock, it's very similar to a prospectus that you would receive when you buy stock. It's regulated by the Federal Trade Commission, and then various states also have some regulations governing the UFOC. And it contains 23 items in it that are required items, in addition to requiring that the audited financials be there, that a list of franchisees and who are in the system and who have left the system be included, and some other items. The franchise agreement is an exhibit to the UFOC, and there are other exhibits as well. Those 23 items are required to be written in what's called plain English, which is always a tough thing for lawyers out there like myself when we're writing these documents to do, because we're accustomed to writing in a legalese way that is very, you know, those of us who are transactional attorneys are much more comfortable writing a document in certain type of way that expresses ourselves, but may not be easily understood by the layperson.
Right.
The UFOC is required to be written to be understood by the average person, to be understood in plain English.
And so these 23 items are really meant for individuals who are looking to buy a franchise to review and read. And item one is great. It talks about what kind of competition you're going to experience, in your in this industry. It talks about any affiliated companies and predecessor companies to the company you're dealing with as a franchisor. And that's very valuable information because it can let you know if you're required to buy product from somebody, you know, whether that company is an affiliated company, or this document will also identify whether the supplier of the products is providing any financial rewards back to the franchisor for that privilege. In addition, it'll tell you about whether the company's experienced any bankruptcy in the past. It'll tell you about litigation, and this can be a red flag that you should be looking at. Are the franchisees suing the franchisor? And if so, this may be something you should stay away from.
Right.
There's just there's a tremendous amount of information in there. There's an identification of the trademark. There's all the financial information in items 5 through 7. Lay out exactly what you could expect to be paying initially and in the first few months of operation, what you could expect. So there's a tremendous amount of information in that document.
Right. So basically, the UFOC really tells everything in detail, and I guess by law, the franchisee has to get this when they first start looking at the franchise. The franchisor gives this to the franchisee for their review and part of their due diligence. And I think you're right, Marty, what you said before. I mean, this is one of the best things ever for the franchisee as part of the due diligence, because you need to know everything. Which brings me to my the next question, Nancy. What should a prospective franchisee look for in going through a UFOC? You've mentioned a few things like the financials of the franchisor, and a good point you brought up was franchisees that are no longer in the system. What happened there? What were there any problems? I help people with financing nationwide. I see a lot of franchisees making quick decisions. We're always telling people make sure they do their due diligence when they're looking at a few different franchises. But besides a couple of those things, anything else real important in the UFOC they should really mainly concentrate on?
I want to reiterate that I think it's very, very important to go through those audited financials, and that I think that a very experienced accountant who has had a background in looking at franchise financials is essential. And as a part of that, as I said, it's a two-part process. One, to review the financials, from the perspective of that potential franchisee, and to see when they could be making money, when will they be in the black. And that's a natural thing for an accountant to be able to look at and take a look at the royalties and the advertising fees and any other fees that they're going to be required to pay, and the cost of the purchase of the inventory that they may need to have on hand and so forth, and do an analysis. And the other piece of it is to evaluate, again, the franchisor's strength, because, a scary thing is to have the franchisor go into bankruptcy. And interestingly enough, I've seen in the last 6 to 9 months, I've been seeing and getting phone calls from people who are experiencing a franchisor who've gone into bankruptcy. This is very scary, because what happens is you're dealing with a trustee in bankruptcy or a receiver who has obtained the rights to the trademark and to the system, to the franchise system, but so that you're paying them royalties. You're still required to pay them royalties and other fees, but you're not getting the support that you were getting before. You may not be able to get the product that you need to keep your stores open. So you're still paying royalties, and you're not getting anything in return. So that's very, very frightening, and there isn't an awful lot that a franchisee can do in that situation other than to find other sources for their product. So it's very, very important that the financials be reviewed. And as far as talking to franchisees that are in the system and franchisees that have left the system, I think you just need to pick their brains as much as you can to find out everything. Go visit their stores. Really get a feel for what you're buying. This is an investment. And even if it costs, if it's a minimal franchise fee up front, and there are some that are out there that are pretty low cost and they may be home-based, you still are investing your time, and you're investing other money down the road in buying product or in supplies that you may need, or just in your own energy and own the value of your own time. So
you know, people say, well, gee, I don't know that I need to have the advice of counsel when I'm only spending, you know, a minimal amount for this franchise. But the reality is down the road, this franchise could cost you a lot of money if it goes sour, and so you do need advice.
Yeah, it's a good point. It becomes their life, and also we see a lot of people rolling over their retirement.
Yes, I see that all the time. There are many, many people out there that don't have the financial wherewithal to start the franchise just with their own funds. And it is a little frightening to me because, you know, I know there are companies out there that have the rollover of the 401k or their IRA, which then becomes a shareholder of a C corporation and as a result is able to lend them that money from the 401k or IRA. They're able to use that money when they wouldn't be able to under the rules of as a standard 401k or IRA. They might not qualify to be able to use that money.
Right. Pre-qualifies people every day, and we always make sure they have plenty of cash reserve, money to live on. Get them for the, they don't have to take a first-year salary from the franchise.
No, and part of the problem on it with this is that when they're borrowing the money from their 401k or their IRA, they're actually putting it at risk when it wouldn't be if they didn't.
Right. Absolutely.
In other words,
are you able to stick around for another segment?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay,
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Franchise Interviews on Blog Talk Radio on this Sunday, March 16th. And we're continuing part two of our interview with franchise attorney Nancy Lenard. And in part two, Nancy goes deeper into some of the common pitfalls aspiring entrepreneurs can run into if they don't hire a franchise attorney. So enjoy, and we'll see you again tomorrow for another great show.
What are some of the documents that a potential franchisee may have to sign?
Well, there are quite a number of documents, actually, that can be required to sign. Obviously, the franchise agreement itself, this is the document, as opposed to the UFOC, which is the 23 items plus the exhibits and so forth, that's there for everyone to look at and learn about the business. The franchise agreement itself is actually the legal document that governs the relationship between the franchisor and franchisee. This is the actual contract that you, as a franchisee, would be signing. And so it's very, very important. I've actually run into situations in which the UFOC will identify certain things that the franchisor says he is going to do, and when it comes to the franchise agreement, they're not actually in the franchise agreement itself that the franchisor is going to be doing them. This is very problematic because the contract is the franchise agreement, not the UFOC. So no matter what they're promising verbally or what they're promising in the UFOC, if it's not in the franchise agreement, and in writing in that document, that's the contract. That's what's binding on the franchisor, so that's very problematic. In addition to that document, the franchisee or potential franchisee could be asked to sign some other documents, such as a software license agreement. If, for example, the franchise requires that you use certain point-of-sale software, you may be required to license that from the franchisor. It might be proprietary software to the franchisor, and you may be required to sign that. There may be a personal guarantee to the franchise agreement that's very typical. If you're taking the franchise in a corporate name or a limited liability company, if you're holding it as an entity in one of those capacities, they're going to ask that you also sign a personal guarantee. It may be you and your spouse. So it's important to know what it is that you're being personally obligated to do. In addition, if the franchisor is actually lending you money, you may be required to sign a promissory note and a security agreement, which gives the franchisor rights to possibly even come in and take over assets of the business. So, again, these are very important legal documents to review. Lastly, and very importantly, most franchises, if they're not home-based, are going to have some physical location, typically a retail location. So the lease is a very big part of the documents that a franchisee will be required to eventually have to sign. Well, a lease, unlike a franchise agreement, which may or may not be negotiable, a lease is a highly negotiable document. And this is something that our office handles all the time. We do between 40 and 60 shopping center and mall leases every year. We have relationships with franchisors in which we are their recommended law firm for review of their franchisees' leases. And as a result, it's a real win-win situation for the franchisor and the franchisees in those systems because we ensure that the franchisor's provisions in the franchise agreement are incorporated into the lease. In addition, we make sure that the business terms that have been negotiated and are usually incorporated into a letter of intent are also included in the lease. We cover various provisions. We have an exhibit that we attach to every one of our leases that can save a franchisee on their bottom line every single month because a tenant in a commercial lease is going to be required to pay common area maintenance charges, known as CAM charges. And what is included in those common area maintenance charges that are passed through to the tenants on a prorated basis can vary. And for example, does something that comes up that's required to be repaired because the landlord or another tenant in the shopping center or the mall caused the problem, should that be passed through to all the tenants? And we don't think so as part of common area maintenance. Should capital expenditures such as roof, a new roof on the premises, should that be passed through to the tenants? We don't think so. Should the costs that the landlord is spending on leases, on actually advertising for empty spaces and filling with tenants, should that be passed through? And again, we don't think so. We have 28 items like that that we attach as an exhibit to every one of the leases that we're involved with that are exclusions from what can be included in these common area maintenance charges. And because of those exclusions, we know that we can save you on your bottom line every single month as a tenant. And again, there are other provisions in the leases, such as the remedies that the landlord can have if you're in default, making sure that the premises are compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act, and getting a warranty from the landlord, making sure that there is a warranty from the landlord about hazardous substances compliance. And all of these things are really critical to the franchisee and to the tenant, because they can be sued if there isn't some sort of a warranty from the landlord and indemnification, meaning a hold harmless, where the landlord would come in and defend you if you were sued. So those are very important provisions. And even if going back to the franchise agreement, we like to see that that the franchisee is given an indemnification, again, a hold harmless, for trademark infringement. If there is any sort of action that is brought against you as a franchisee in the system because of the trademark that the franchisee is licensing to you, we feel it's very important that the franchisor come in and defend and hold you harmless from any costs and expenses that you might incur, which is called indemnification, for any trademark action that would be brought against you.
So obviously here there's a lot of documents. I mean, it's you know, all more the reason to use someone like yourself, Nancy. I mean, it's, you know, you talked about the lease. We see a lot of times that sometimes is the most difficult process, you know, people finding a lease and location and you having to go through all the lease terms. So you brought up a very good point there. It's just not the franchise agreement and UFOC. There's other documents here, you know, to consider and have.
Documents. And usually when we get a new client who's a potential franchisee, you know, typically we start with reviewing the franchise documents. We then help them set up their legal entity as a corporation or a limited liability company. And then the third part is to help them with the lease for their location. And then eventually, once they're open, we can help them with employment matters and setting up drug and alcohol policies for their employees and sexual harassment policies. You know, we're here basically to be on their team, to help them as they go through and grow, and eventually when they want to sell the business, we're there as well. And so it's very important to have legal representation and legal counsel that can be there with them, I think, through the whole process of buying and owning a franchise.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Nancy, you've had the opportunity to work with many franchisees. What characteristics do you think make a successful franchisee?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I think, you know, the starting out with a good franchise is important. And, you know, just as a quick little side story, I can tell you about a franchisee called me when they were a potential franchisee and retained our services. And I advised them because of the extent of litigation, and again, this goes back to my earlier comment, to look at the UFOC and those first few items in particular, but to look at the litigation history of the company. This particular franchise is one that I'm not fond of. I won't mention who they are, but they charge a fee for the application before you've even been given the UFOC. So this particular person came to me. They had already spent about $8,000 up front just to apply to be a franchisee. I told them there was a great deal of litigation, that franchisees were actually suing this franchisor, and that to me that was a huge red flag and they ought to stay away. This particular person said, I've already spent $8,000. I'm not willing to walk away from that. I'm willing to take the risk, and entered into that franchise. A year later, almost to the day, I got an email from this particular client who said, I should have listened to you a year later, and this franchise, that $8,000 was pennies compared to the hundred and some thousand dollars that I have spent in a year trying to build this business and trying to make it a success when the franchisor has undermined it in many, many ways. And I'm now part of a class action lawsuit against the franchisor, and I'm selling the business. Can you help me with the sale?
So the bottom line is, you really didn't do enough homework, not enough due diligence. Yep, I didn't have someone like yourself reviewing everything.
Well, we did review it, but it was already at the point that this particular person had already put out money before they had gotten that to that point. So unfortunately, he didn't listen.
And that was non-refundable, right. $8,000. Yeah.
Didn't want to walk away from the $8,000, and in the long run, it cost him $100,000+. In the meantime, so I think, you know, doing the due diligence, doing the research, but also I think tenacity, hard work, making sure that you have good franchisor training and support, that you have a good business location, that you have a strong lease, all of which are, I think, important characteristics to make for a successful franchise. There's many components.
Great. Nancy, we have about 30 seconds. What's the best way someone can get in touch with you? Should they go to your website?
My website is www.lenardlaw.com, and that's spelled with all A's. It's LanardLaw.com.
Okay.
And it's very comprehensive. I have a lot of articles on the website and a lot of other information that we didn't touch on. Or they can call me at 215-525-1165. We represent franchisees nationwide, and would love to work with your listeners.
Absolutely. Well, Nancy, we're going to have you back, because you're right. We didn't get to cover everything I wanted to ask you today.
So. I went quickly.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Nancy. You have a great day today.
Thank you very much, Marty and Don. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Nancy.
Good. Okay.
Wow, very informative, Don, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is so important for, you know, when someone's starting up a franchise. I mean, when she's talking about some of the different documents to review, people just have to be careful. Do their due diligence, of course.
Absolutely.
Just be careful. You can make a lot of money in franchising, but there's a lot
sure.
of prep work beforehand is the bottom line.
Absolutely. Well, another great job, Don. You know,
yeah,
and thanks everyone for listening and, you know, again, making the show a big success. Thanks, Paul, behind the programming desk today. And don't forget to listen next week. Again, we have Miami Rice next week, Don. So, again,
yep.
Have your appetite for that. And go to franchiseinterviews.com. And Ken Six is up next.
Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Franchise Interviews, where we're asking the franchisepreneur who owns one. I'm your host, Marty McDermott, with my co-host, Don Johnson. And if you've ever dreamed about one day owning your own business, then you've come to the right place.
We have a great show this morning. We're meeting with another fabulous Snell & Wilmer attorney, Holly Shilliday, who has loads of helpful information to share with our listeners on a real timely topic. Given today's economic conditions, many businesses are heading into financial troubles, such as bankruptcy, and franchise systems are no exception. Holly will speak to our audience on how systems should prevent bankruptcy, protect their rights, and handle bankruptcy. Holly has represented and advised lenders and numerous franchisors in bankruptcy cases filed by franchisees and their guarantors, and that's coming up in segment two of Franchise Interviews. Our first segment today is being brought to you by Franchise Interviews LLC, and Franchise Interviews gives you an up-close and behind-the-scenes look at franchising and entrepreneurship through our website, franchiseinterviews.com, where you can hear and read interviews as well as get insight tips from some of the most successful sources in franchising. Our weekly franchise radio show on Blog Talk Radio, where each week you get to hear a new interview with franchisors, franchisees, franchise authors, franchise experts, and franchise attorneys, and our monthly franchise newsletter, which is a must-read for anyone looking to buy a franchise. And don't forget to check out our new podcast, Great Quotes in Franchising. And Don, welcome back to another edition of Franchise Interviews. How's your week going, my friend?
Okay, going pretty well. How about yourself, Marty?
Beautiful weather out there today. Fall is definitely here, and it's hard to imagine. We're going into October, next week?
Right, where you are, you see the change in the leaves at all, the colors? Not really
it's
Ryan.
It's beautiful, yeah. Not quite yet. I mean, they're changing, but, you know, October is really the month, you know, to come up here. It's really pretty that time of year, you know. So it's, but I feel it coming. But, yeah, September just kind of flew by, didn't it?
Yeah, it's always kind of an interesting time of year. I always just have a lot of memories this time of year of school and college and playing soccer and playing football out when I was younger in the streets with friends and so forth.
Absolutely. It's interesting because we're near Lafayette College, you know, Don, so it's interesting seeing all the kids head back to school and stuff like that, and, you know, they look all motivated and excited, and, you know.
Time of their lives.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's an exciting time of their lives, you know, so it is. I have a lot of good memories myself of, you know, September, so that's fantastic. Our last show, Don, we met with Linda Searless, who's the founder of the Baby Power concept, and Linda started the business in a church basement, and she turned it into a profitable franchise business, and she's rewarding a parent-child play experience to her clients. The business Baby Power is a program for children ages 6 months to 5 years, which would include us because we have kids in that range, and the mission to build a communication between families through the Baby Power program that lasts a lifetime. It was definitely an interesting type of show, and it was targeted, I think, more the mompreneurs. So you can say. What were your thoughts on last week?
I mean, obviously a very smart woman. I mean, real interesting mom and pop type of franchise is how I would put it. I mean, it's interesting how hands-on, you know, she is. And I was really impressed by her business instincts. I mean, she does so much herself to build up the business. And, you know, she does a lot of the work herself on helping people find their location and to even choose if that person is the right fit to be a franchisee.
Right,
and I thought it was you know, very helpful, you know, type of service for you know, for families and mothers. And you know, I think your wife you gave her a call right after the show, right?
She did. Yeah, she got a lot of great free advice. So thanks, Linda. You know, for speaking to Connie. I think they spoke probably for like an hour on the phone. You know, and she gave a lot of great advice. You know, because our baby's approaching that 1 year old mark. So I was really listening. You know, trying to get a lot of good tips. You know, because, again, this is our first baby, you know, so it was, and you give me a lot of great tips on the show as well, but, yeah, it was, I thought it was very interesting. She had a great quote from the show. It says, if Linda could give advice to other women thinking about starting their own business, she would say, if you love the business, then do it, but be prepared to work harder than you ever have before in your life. Once a dreamer, she believes her life has tracked a song she wrote that states, go to sleep and dream of what you want to be. Go to sleep and dream, remember what you see. And I wasn't going to sing that, by the way. After all, you can dream it, then you can do it. You know, and I think we've kind of like the motivation for today, you know. But
We kidded her about she should write a book. She said she's already, you know, on that path, I guess.
Yeah, and she really should, you know. I mean, it's the market is definitely big enough, and you know, it's just so much information. You know, and you know this when you have kids today. You know, I think there's just too much information. You know, and I really liked her whole philosophy as far as what she's doing.
with her franchise. And, yeah, it is interesting how she's very hands-on.
Right.
You know? And, again, as the franchise grows, you know, it's going to be a little more difficult for her. And they're actually moving into Singapore. Could you imagine that?
Right, yeah.
That's like their next franchise. So
yeah, I mean, early child development is so important. My twins just started their second year of preschool. And, you know, we went last night to the school and talked to the teacher. And I guess it's so important, these early years development.
And that's what I've always read, too, is that, you know, the early years, you know, the first, like, 5 years or 6 years are just really so important, you know. So, but it was a good show, you know. And we're going to have to, as always, you know, keep watching them. You know, it's always interesting to have the newer franchise concepts on the show, you know, and watch how, you know, some of these things just grow. It's just amazing. A couple things, Don. I had, I don't know if you watched, you probably didn't have time this morning, putting on your suit and tie. Cartridge World was on Good Morning America. It was about 8:45, and it's a nice plug for Cartridge World. We've had them on the show twice up to this point. We had Gregory Carafello the first time. And it was on August 16th, I guess, I can't remember, it was last year. We had Jeff Beer and Norm Friedman. And you can actually hear that show if you go to franchiseinterviews.com and go to show descriptions and go down to August 16th. And I think that'll actually take you to gofranchise.com as well, where you can hear the whole show. But very fantastic franchise. I mean, we've been following Cartridge World for a while now as well, and they're just exceptional. I mean, their growth has been tremendous. And, you know, this whole green thing, you know, taking off and people becoming a lot more environmentally conscious and people looking to save money as well. I think Cartridge World saves you about 30% on
it's a big saving. We use their service as well. And I've seen their growth. We finance people and, you know, solid track record. You know, and a lot of our lending sources are very favorable towards Cartridge World. So I'm not surprised they're getting all that press.
Right, absolutely. So we'll have to have them back on sometime in 2009 as well, as we watch those guys continue to grow. Here's a definition from Joe Matthews, author of Street Smart Franchising. And we had Joe on our show probably about a year and a half ago, and he was just an incredible guest. He defines franchising, and there's a lot of different definitions for franchising, but he says the franchise relationship is grounded in a sacred trust. And I think that's a very powerful word, sacred trust, and mutual respect between franchisees and franchisors. Each has a mission, critical job to do. Each greatly impacts the other. Like combat soldiers in a platoon, franchisees and franchisors completely depend on each other to execute their jobs well to ensure mutual survival. Just thought that was very powerful, using that word sacred trust, you know, and mutual respect. Because I think really that's what franchising is, you know. I mean, sometimes you'll see it as defined as like a legal relationship, and but you and I have gone as far on the show as, you know, defining it as a marriage, you know. And
partnership and marriage, yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think it's really, you know, almost that big. So just thought that was a great definition. I know you had some interesting articles.
Yeah, a few things. First party, remember next week we'll just mention a couple of shows coming up. William Fleichman from I Sold It franchise. That's October 2nd. October 9th, Peter Baldine of Moran Industries.
That's right.
Interesting automotive concepts, and I'll be talking shortly about an article in the automotive industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the future shows, we're having the Entrepreneur Source, a very successful franchise consulting franchise.
Right.
Other shows, Business Partners, The Core, and You.
There's a lot of them, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting, you know, some very familiar concepts, and there's some new concepts as well. You know, I think Cousin Subs might be one of them in December.
Right.
And
Valpak.
I mean, then we got Superior Wash in the beginning of January. I think that's the first show of the year. So some very interesting and exciting concepts. A lot of diversity over the next 4 to 5 months, you know. So
that's what we're trying to do. A lot of information, help a lot of people out there nationwide, introduce them to different concepts, and just the whole process of franchising.
And I think that's what people like most about the show, Don, you know, is, I mean, we really talk about everything. I think we give the diversity, you know. And, again, we talk about, as you and I mentioned, like the good, bad, and the ugly, you know. I mean, a lot of times we'll mention to people that, you know, franchising is not for everybody. In fact, it's probably not for most people. As much as you and I are very pro-franchise, you know, we believe in franchising, again, it isn't for everybody, and, you know, we kind of give both sides of the story, you know, so this way people or our listeners can make a very informed decision.
It's like today, you know, having Holly Shilliday talking about unfortunately situations when there's bankruptcies or just bad situations between the franchisor and franchisees. So she'll be talking a little bit about that today, and that's coming up. And I just want to mention quickly, October 18th and 19th, there's a franchise show out on Long Island, New York, Marty. It's going to be at Suffolk County College Saturday and Sunday. People wanting information, go to longislandfranchiseexpo.com. And that's October 18th and 19th. I think there'll be over 60 franchise companies represented at that show.
And the small ones are great, Don, too, I think. I mean, you and I have been to some smaller franchise shows. You know, a lot of times you and I are used to going to the big ones in, like, the convention centers. And, again, those are great. But, you know, the smaller ones I find sometimes can be a little more intimate, you know, where you actually get to spend a lot of time talking to the franchisor. So I think people in that area, if you're interested in franchising, to take advantage of it.
Exactly. Good. Here's something, Marty, interesting through the Associated Press. Still close to the vest, KFC is shoring up security for 68-year-old secret recipe. That's out of my local paper, the Asbury Park Press here in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And this is through Louisville, Kentucky. It starts off, Marty, the secret's out at KFC. Well, sort of. Colonel Harlan Sanders' handwritten recipe of 11 herbs and spices was removed Tuesday from safekeeping at KFC's corporate offices for the first time in decades. Temporary relocation is allowing KFC to revamp security around the yellowing sheet of paper that contains one of the country's most famous corporate secrets. The brand's top executive admitted his nerves were a flutter despite the tight security he lined up for the operation. He says, "I don't want to be the president who loses the recipe." KFC president Roger Eaton says, "Imagine how terrifying that would be." The recipe that launched the chicken chain was placed in a lockbox and was handcuffed to security expert Bo Deitel, who climbed aboard an armored car that whisked away with an escort from off-duty police officers. Eaton's parting words to Deitel, "Keep it safe." Man, a lot of emotions going up with this secret recipe here.
It's incredible. I've told students this story before, and a lot of them don't even believe it, you know, but I think it makes it even more appealing to KFC that, you know, they treat the recipe in this manner, you know, that it's handwritten from Colonel Sanders on a yellow piece of paper. I mean, it's just
important franchising history. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So important is the 68-year-old concoction that coats the chain's original recipe chicken that only two company executives at any time have access to it. The company refuses to release their names or titles, and it uses multiple suppliers who produce and blend the ingredients but know only a part of the entire contents. Deitel, a former New York City police detective, assured Eaton that the iconic recipe would be safe. There's no way, shape, or form that anybody's going to get their hands on this recipe. He said, if they get their hands
great.
On this recipe, they have to take me with them.
Wow, that's dedication, huh?
That's not the guy I want protecting me someday.
Oh, absolutely.
The security firm is also handling security improvements for the recipe at headquarters, but he wouldn't say what changes they're making. KFC executives said they decided to upgrade security after retrieving the recipe amid preparations to add a new line of original recipe chicken strips. The recipe has been stashed at the company headquarters for decades. For more than 20 years, has been tucked away in a filing cabinet equipped with two combination locks. To reach the cabinet, the keepers of the recipe would first open a vault and unlock three locks on a door that stood in front of the cabinet.
Wow.
The vials of the herbs and spices are also stored in the secret filing cabinet. The smell is overwhelming when you open it, said one of the two keepers of the recipe. The biggest prize, though, is a single sheet of notebook paper yellowed by age that lays out the entire formula, including exact amounts for each ingredient. And it goes on here. I guess Sanders developed the formula in 1940 at his tiny restaurant in southeastern Kentucky and used it to launch the KFC chain in the early 1950s. He died in 1980, as we talked about in past shows, but his likeness is still central to KFC's marketing. The recipe to him in later years was everything he stood for, said Shirley Kottmiller, his personal secretary for about 12 years.
That's a great story, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they just, KFC, they're so clever with their marketing, you know. It's you know, we've had a lot of great stories about KFC over the last 2 years. You know, one of my favorites with them, I don't know if you remember this one, we actually used to have it on our homepage of franchiseinterviews.com, was when they did their new logo.
and you could actually see it from space. I don't know if you remember that one.
and you said,
who's looking at it, you know? And but the whole thing was they just got so much PR on it. I mean, it was in, you know, every major newspaper in the United States, and there was a picture of it, you know, and it was up on our website. And it's just, they're very clever, you know, the way they go about these things, you know? And that's interesting. But it's a great story, though. It's a lot of fun.
Definitely. Here's something from the Restaurant Finance Monitor, Marty, by the Franchise Times Magazine, their newsletter. Franchise Times Magazine recently completed its annual Franchise Times 200 report. The usual mega franchise companies like McDonald's, KFC, Burger King, Subway, Pizza Hut, Wendy's, Taco Bell, Tim Hortons, Domino's, and Dunkin' Donuts, of course, made the top list. The monitor took the Franchise Times data one step further and compared 81 companies, now these are all restaurants, of course, in the 2007 report to the data that was reported in the 2000 version. So they kind of made a comparison of 5 years apart and a couple interesting stats. One, I guess, it says here, big-time growth at Jimmy John's. According to their computations, the fastest-growing franchise restaurant chain over the past 5 years was Jimmy John's Gourmet Sandwich Shops.
Wow.
Sandwich shop chain owned by the entrepreneur Jimmy John Littaud and the private equity firm. Is also involved, but they grew from $67 million in sales in 2002 to $386 million in 2007, an increase of over 570%.
That's incredible. Do you have any Jimmy John's near you, or have you been to one?
I've financed a few, but I've never.
You have, okay. Yeah, I've worked with them many years ago, Franchise America, but and there is one actually, I think it's in Easton, and I've passed it a couple times, but never got in there. I really have to go in there because that growth is, that's incredible.
Right. Well, they went from 167 restaurants in 2002 to over, to 632 by the end of 2007, so big time
that's
growth for them. The fastest growing restaurant chain's sales percent, one Jimmy John's, two Cold Stone Creamery, then you have Wingstop, Qdoba, Buffalo Wild Wings, Zaxby's, Tim Hortons, McAllister's Deli, Panera Bread, coming in at 9, and then Quiznos at number 10.
Wow.
It says here, sales growth, I guess, greater than a billion. And, you know, some of the big, you know, the biggies we mentioned before, like Subway, McDonald's, KFC, also Dunkin' Donuts, Pizza Hut, Chili's, Sonic Drive-In, Domino's Pizza, Wendy's, Quiznos, Applebee's, and Chick-fil-A.
Wow.
So
that's incredible.
Yeah, and it looks like this restaurant Qdoba looks like it's doing pretty well with you know, percentage growth and Wingstop, Zaxby's. It's always interesting stats to see which franchise systems are having success.
The competition is so intense too, isn't it, Don? I mean, you know, some of these names that you just kind of threw out. You know, I mean, it's just that industry. I mean, wow, you're talking major competition.
Right. And just one last thing, I guess I see here Baskin-Robbins, who we had on the show a couple months ago, they having some nice growth. They went from over 4,700 open locations nationwide to over 5,800. So,
wow, good for them.
Well. Here's something else from the Franchise Times Magazine. Auto Industry Drivers Want It Now by Jonathan Mays. Is this a good time to be in the business of fixing cars? Well, that depends. How does that half-filled glass look? But the glass half full crowd, there is this reason for optimism. People are driving older cars. Auto sales have fallen like a brick over the last several months, taking with them not just domestic automakers hurting from lower SUV sales, but also the import company like Toyota, known more for gas-sipping models. Fewer new cars on the road means more older cars on the road, and more older cars means more business. Yet the pessimists may have an even more notable number. The number of miles driven in the U.S. has fallen each of the past 6 months. That is hurting an industry generally considered recession-proof by keeping cars off the road. Cars that aren't driven as much don't wear out as quickly. The number of miles driven has been declining for the last 6 months, says Mike Rippey, CEO of 1-800-Radiator, who we had on recently, a California-based wholesale radiator franchise. That's never happened before, he says. The effect is, across all auto parts, if a car is driven less, it takes longer for parts to wear out. Makes sense.
Does make sense, yeah.
It goes on, which view is winning out? So far, it appears that the pessimists have it. While some companies have reported strong sales recently, many others have shown weakness, and stock prices for several of them have fallen. That makes sense. For years, the auto industry has been able to rely on a simple fact. People keep driving, miles traveled had been increasing steadily since the early 80s when gas prices began falling after the previous price spike of the late 70s. The recent declines have followed the run-up in gas prices. Most recently, the number of miles driven in the U.S. fell 3.7% in May, according to the Federal Highway Administration. That continued a steady, significant decline that began in November. More people are using mass transit, which has increased significantly in many markets, and the popularity of gas-sipping vehicles like scooters has also increased. The decreased driving does have a ripple effect on aftermarket companies that deal in both service issues and parts sales, Marty. For instance, if people are driving less, they may take 4 months to need an oil change instead of three. It may take them a year to need a maintenance checkup instead of 9 months. It says there's a domino effect, says Sid Wilson, senior analyst with Kevin, Dan, and Partners, who focuses on the auto aftermarket industry. Now that six-month repair takes 8 months, something you needed every 9 months takes 12 months. It has, of course, an impact on the whole industry.
Right, right. That's interesting. I didn't, you know, and I didn't think about that when we had Kelly Grace of 1-800-RADIATOR on the show.
Right.
You know, he says that people are keeping their autos a lot longer, you know, with
right.
the economy being the way it is, you know. So over time, there are parts that will have to be replaced, radiators being one of them. You know, I think it's every 7 years you change a radiator. So it does make sense, you know. I mean, again, I guess there's good and bad with certain industries as the economy is the way it is today.
As many people are delaying repairs on cars for economic concerns, we do believe that gas prices are causing some drivers to simply defer major repairs and seek alternative transportation, said
right.
Todd Left, chief executive of AMCO Transmission. In the current environment, companies do well when they have high margins, which enable them to underprice their competitors. And service companies do well when they offer something of value. Companies like Texas-based Christian Brothers Automotive, which lures customers with a clean, customer-friendly environment that targets mostly women.
Hmm.
And it says here, this is interesting, Americans bought 13.6 million new cars in May. That's down 18% from the same period a year ago,
down
according
18%.
To the industry research firm Auto
wow.
Data. The worst drop since October of 2002 was that decline in auto sales.
That's
so,
something. That's pretty significant,
18%
in that industry. You know, that's a lot. It's does that mean you're going to be driving to work on a scooter?
I've already looked into it. Online.
There you go.
I've ordered two.
There you go.
Well, it just says, while that means cars today are more reliable, that still means people are holding on to their cars longer. As the average age of an auto gets older, they fail more often, Rippey said, and while people can
right.
put off car repairs, they can't put them off forever. If a radiator starts to go, they can keep putting water in this thing for 4 or 5 months, he said, but eventually you'll have to pay the piper.
That's great. That's an interesting article.
Yeah.
So good articles today. Well, the show today, Don, is being brought to you by Franchise Interviews, LLC, and Franchise Interviews gives you an up-close and behind-the-scenes look at franchising and entrepreneurship through our website, franchiseinterviews.com, where you can hear and read interviews, as well as get insight tips from some of the most successful sources in franchising. Our weekly franchise radio show on Blog Talk Radio, each week you get to hear a new interview with franchisors, franchisees, franchise authors, franchise experts, and franchise attorneys. And our monthly franchise newsletter, which is a must-read for anyone looking to buy a franchise. And don't forget to check out our Great Quotes and Franchising podcast. And as we were saying earlier, Don, we have a great show today. We're meeting with another fabulous Snell & Wilmer attorney, Holly Shilliday, who has loads of helpful information to share with our audience on a real timely topic, especially what we're talking about today. Given today's economic conditions, many businesses are heading into financial troubles, such as bankruptcy, and franchise systems are unfortunately no exception. And Holly's going to speak to our audience on how systems can prevent bankruptcy. She's got a lot of great tips, protect their rights, and also handle bankruptcy, you know, God forbid it occurs. Hey, Holly, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good, Holly. How are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you.
That's
I have an
great.
Older car, by the way, 2001.
There you go. So you confirmed our article. That's great.
And keep pumping water in your radiator when it gets low.
Yeah, there you go.
What?
Yeah. Holly, we'll like to start off asking our guests where they're calling from today.
I'm in Littleton, Colorado today, and it's a beautiful blue sky. It's going to be about 80.
I imagine. Yeah, it's interesting because as long as Don and I, we've been doing this show 2 years now, Holly, I think it seems like it's the capital, doesn't it, Don, for franchising?
Right, yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing how many I was saying we're going to have to eventually move our offices out there at some point.
Perfect.
You know? Yeah. Holly, with the economy the way it is today, what trends are you seeing today with respect to franchise systems? In other words, have you seen an increase in the amount of bankruptcy situations or a decrease in the amount of new franchise sales?
You know, that's a good question. And you would think that there would be an increase in bankruptcies, but actually there isn't. But I can tell you that there's an increase in franchise failures. A lot of times the businesses don't even bother with the bankruptcy part of it. They go ahead and go dark. And if we're seeing bankruptcies at all, it's by the principal of the company, because the principal is typically the person who guarantees, you know, the franchise agreement, the lease, the equipment loan. So they're the ones that are trying to get the bankruptcy relief. But generally, I'm noticing that sales are down, you know, cost of goods are up, franchisees are unable to locate new money to continue their business operations, and so that's why we're not really seeing any reorganization. They're just businesses going dark.
Interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, but talking about franchisees and franchisors, there's actually been an increase in franchisor bankruptcies. I'm sure you've probably already talked about the parent company of Bennigan's and Steak and Ale filing. There was Village Inn, Ground Round. There's been some big ones in the past, and
right.
Some of them are successful and some of them are not.
What's usually the reason for that happening? Just poor, you know, just overall poor management, or they weren't able to change with the times? Marty and I reached, you know, go over and a lot of the shows talking about how franchisors updating their look and their system. Is that really, you know, what's happening a lot of times when these companies are going under, Holly?
I do believe so. I think a lot of the systems may be dated, and if they don't keep up with the times, they just the sales fall off, and it's hard to generate new franchisees. Sometimes there's too much growth. You know, you have too many of them in the system, and it's kind of hard to handle that growth. And, you know, there's a number of factors. Right now, I think the economy is playing a big role in franchise failures.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah, it was interesting. The ones that you mentioned, Holly, you know, I mean, these were ones that I frequented, you know, 20 years ago, you know, like your, you know, Steak and Ale and Ground Round, you know,
right.
Miss some of those places, you know, it's, but I think, as you were saying, Don, I think a lot of them probably haven't changed with the times, you know, and
right.
That was one part of it, so that is interesting.
Yeah,
the other thing is, right. There's definitely
I mean, like the Ground Round, I went there as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you'd love to, you know, be able to take your kids there one day. It's just sad sometimes, but
right.
You know, I guess that's business. That's the way of the world, but it's always unfortunate.
And Ground Round is still around. I think
right.
More probably on the East Coast than out here, but
right.
You know, it definitely has had its problems in the past. The other thing I'm noticing is that there's a decrease in new franchise sales, but on the flip side, there seems to be an increase in existing franchise transfers. And I think a lot of that is because the franchisors don't like to report a failure or one of their locations going dark. So it's better to find a new operator to go in and to keep the location going.
That's interesting. And they don't want this thing showing up in their the new, I guess, the franchise disclosure document, Holly, I guess, right? It's kind of like that.
That's right. The reporting is brutal. And, you know, I'm sure this year, looking at the filings, you're going to see a lot of new listings for the failures and for bankruptcies and lawsuits.
Right. That's
and that trickles down to when a franchisee is reviewing that franchisor for investment. I'm involved in franchise financing, Holly, so, you know, our lenders more than ever are looking at the default rate, the failure rate of certain franchise systems, and I've witnessed more franchisors you know, taking over that
right.
Failing you know, franchisee, just to not, you know, avoid having a default or a failure. But we've helped a lot of people to buy a franchise from corporate that initially was with a franchisee. So, you know, it's harder for people to get financing when that default rate is high. So franchisors are smart to kind of take that approach.
Yeah, and I think that lenders are smart too, and they're looking at the type of franchise that their customers want to open and deciding if it's something that they want to invest in. You
right.
know, there's definitely, you know, good franchise systems and not so good franchise systems, and the lenders
right.
need to be a part of that that process.
Interesting, yeah.
So staying with, the topic of bankruptcy in its various forms, let's begin with preventing bankruptcy. What are some of the warning signs that a franchisor should look for, Holly?
You know, to me, the number one sign is when a franchisee stops communicating, and that's with the lender, with the franchisor, with the landlord.
Right.
Also, failure to pay royalties or advertising fees. If there's revolving door management, meaning they can't keep someone in charge, delinquent taxes. I think if there's an increase in complaints regarding a franchise, that's a good sign that something is going on. And then another thing I was thinking about was if they're suddenly paying COD, that means that they've probably not paid a lot of their vendors.
Right.
So those are probably the best warning signs of something's going wrong.
Right.
Interesting.
What happens when a say it just happened to me just recently, a franchise someone's coming to us for financing. They already paid the franchise fees, and now the franchisor system just dissolved. They're no longer operating. So what happens? So that person, I guess their franchise fee is possibly might not get it back. But what about the existing franchisees who are part of a dissolved franchise system? What do they keep doing? Do they still keep those vendor and supplier relationships to keep their business going under the same name?
Yes, I think that's right. There are protections under the bankruptcy code, at least if the franchisor files bankruptcy, for those who are have franchise agreements or license agreements.
Right.
And so, although there's power of the debtor to reject and assume contracts, if the debtor is actually the licensor, there are things in the code that will protect the licensee. But interestingly, in, say, the Bennigan's case, it looks like some franchisees may be taking over 40 to 60 of the company-owned operated restaurants. So I think that what we're going to see is kind of a flip where the franchisees own the system, the marks, and everything, and continue on the brand, even, after the bankruptcy filing. So it's not impossible, but if the franchise system doesn't file bankruptcy, basically the franchisee has a claim against the franchisor and can sue them on that claim. But one of the big things we say in our business is you can't get blood out of a turnip. So if they
right.
have no assets or nothing to go after, you're basically going to get a judgment on a piece of paper that's suitable for framing.
That's something. And this is why the trust and communication and honesty, I guess, are so important, when we're talking about franchising, Holly. So you can kind of avoid these things happening, I guess the frequent communication with your franchisees, I guess, is one way to kind of prevent something like this from happening.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if everyone's honest about what's going on and
mm-hmm.
keep those lines of communications open, the parties are more willing to work together.
Right.
And, I think to start off with, it's good to look at who the parties are that you're dealing with when you have a troubled franchise. First, you have, of course, the franchisee. Second, the landlord, who's an important player in this, the franchisor,
right.
and also the lender. And the failure to work with any one of these parties typically results in a failed franchise. And what I mean by that is you can enter into a restructuring agreement with your lender to try to work things out, but that's not going to work. It won't survive if the franchisor decides to go ahead and terminate the franchise agreement or if the landlord evicts the franchisee. So that's why you kind of have to all work together of the common goal of keeping this franchise afloat.
That's interesting. So what happens if it's too late, Holly? Like, in other words, let's say that someone's listening to this program, they're realizing that they've overlooked the warning signs and they know their franchisee is beyond help. What do they do then?
That's a great question. I think first, before we get to that point, I want to talk a little bit about what can be done to, bring things back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience is that franchisors oftentimes will give a break on the royalties or the license fees. Either they will reduce them or they will enter into a forbearance agreement where they'll give the franchisee time to, pay back the fees over time. The other thing that a franchisor can do is put together a team, and this is like a team of operations people or ask a successful franchisee to assist a troubled franchisee to identify and deal with operational issues. You can make allowances for marketing. In extreme circumstances, consider relocating the franchise. That probably only works if the franchisor is the landlord.
Right.
If there's communication, then they're more likely to work with you. And that's really the same with lenders. because if the site ends up going dark, unless they have the real estate, the lender's likely to receive pennies on the dollar if they're forced to liquidate the personal property assets. So in a lot of times our lenders are saying it's better to restructure and give them a second chance. So when we get to the point where it's too late and the trust is gone, really there's two options. One is to try to find a new franchisee to take over the location.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not able to do that, then I say quickly terminate the license. Typically, the license agreements are going to have provisions where,
right.
You're going to be in a position to terminate it. So follow the license agreement and the law applicable to the state to the letter, and go ahead and get that license agreement terminated. And what I mean by that is sometimes you have a license agreement that says you have 30 days, so you have to give them the 30-day notice and give them an opportunity to cure. A lot of times you see provisions that are an automatic termination, but just make sure you do it right, because the last thing you want to do is end up in a bankruptcy case where
right.
that franchise agreement is still sitting out there.
Now, what happens if the franchisee files bankruptcy?
Well, first of all, there's going to be three types of bankruptcies that could possibly occur with a franchisee: a Chapter 7 liquidation, a Chapter 13 reorganization, and a Chapter 11 reorganization. So the first thing that happens when a bankruptcy is filed is there's an automatic stay that's in place that prohibits creditors from taking action against the debtor or against property of the state. And just to give you a precursor, a license agreement that has not been properly terminated is property of the state. So you can't take any action with respect to that license agreement once the case has been filed. So the bankruptcy process is supposed to give a breathing spell to the debtor. So Chapter 7 liquidation, you actually have a trustee that's appointed in the case, and the trustee is responsible for taking possession of all the non-exempt assets and to liquidate them for the benefit of the creditors. And a lot of times, you would think that it would happen instantly. You file the bankruptcy and the trustee goes in and takes over operations, but that's not typically the case. Usually, if it's a Chapter 7, the business is already dark. The trustee takes some time before getting in there and before examining the debtor and the books and records. And oftentimes, it just passes through bankruptcy because a secured lender, basically gets everything at the end of the day. So there's nothing for the trustee to do. And that's what when we talk about non-exempt assets, they also have to be unsecured assets. And so that's really a rarity. In a Chapter 11 case, the franchisee remains in possession of the assets, typically continues to operate the business, and the ultimate goal is to propose a plan of reorganization that's going to be voted upon by the creditors. And it's also possible to have a Chapter 11 liquidating case, and that's really the most common type of case we're seeing these days. You look at Sharper Image, Bombay Club, probably even Bennigan's. That's the state is just to sell everything. Sue people for preferences and fraudulent conveyances, and then distribute whatever's left after payment of attorneys to the unsecured creditors. So the debtor in the Chapter 11 we call the debtor in possession. The other type of bankruptcy is a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and that's typically for an individual who is reorganizing, and we're seeing guarantors that are filing Chapter 13. There are strict debt limits and asset limits in those cases, and what we're finding is a lot of times the guarantor is actually above those limits, but they also don't qualify for a Chapter 7. I don't know if you guys know, but back in 2005, well, it was in the papers, there's a change in the bankruptcy laws, so it actually makes it a little more difficult to file bankruptcy.
Right.
But that hasn't stopped the huge increase in bankruptcy filings this year. I think we're up like 28%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you know what percentage, Holly, of companies that file Chapter 11 end up coming out of bankruptcy and
it's
just
extremely rare.
Wow.
Fewer than 10%, I would say.
Oh, my God.
So, well, the interesting thing is a lot of times the license agreement provides that the filing of a bankruptcy by the guarantor is an automatic default of the franchise agreement. And so, in that case, the franchisor can actually terminate the franchise agreement even though the company is not otherwise in default. And we saw that happen a lot after the change in the law in 2005 when guarantors decided, you know, I'm gonna go ahead and file. I don't want to have this potential liability in the future. So I actually had clients that terminated the license agreements of the businesses based on the guarantor file. So, but the next step in the bankruptcy is that the bankruptcy case creates the bankruptcy estate, which consists of all the assets. And that's all defined by state law, and you look and see what the assets are as of the date of the filing. So if the franchise agreement was properly terminated before the petition date, then and the debtor no longer has a right to cure, then that franchise agreement will not become property of the estate. The franchisor may have to work with making sure that the franchisee no longer is using the marks, making sure you get back all that confidential trade secret information, but otherwise you're pretty much done in the process except for filing a proof of claim, which basically sets forth how much this debtor owes you, and perhaps in the future you'll get some money out of the case. But, you know, it's a different situation if you didn't terminate or if the termination was not proper, because then you could get into a battle with the debtor over whether or not that license agreement becomes property of the estate. So you could ask the court to lift a stay if it's a real burden on the franchisor in order to go ahead and get it terminated. But typically, the judges are going to give the debtor some time to try to get all their assets and all their business affairs in order to confirm a plan. So anyway, you have this franchise agreement, and it's kind of interesting what can go on with it in the bankruptcy case. So the first thing is that the debtor can reject the franchise agreement, which means they no longer want to perform their side of the deal. And if that's the case, if it gets rejected, then it's basically done. You revert back to state law, and the franchisor has a claim in the bankruptcy case. But the franchisor may also assume the license agreement. And in order to assume a license agreement or a franchise agreement, the franchisee is going to have to cure all the defaults in order to remain a part of that franchise agreement. So oftentimes there's a dispute among the franchisor and the franchisee about how much money it's going to cost to cure the defaults under the agreement. And, you know, you could have litigation over that. I had a case in Massachusetts where it ended up being the biggest issue of the case, and ultimately the franchise system ended up not successfully assuming those agreements. But, yeah, the real interesting thing is that a franchisee could assume the contract and then assign it to a third party. Wow. So if you're a franchisor, you're like, what, a third party? That's not who I contracted with. There are some protections in the code, like the third party has to prove that they, you know, adequate assurance of future performance, might have to turn over their financials, and, and there's a split in the circuits about whether or not a third party can assume one of these license agreements. There's a Burger King case, for example, that said, come on, there's thousands of Burger Kings across the nation. It doesn't take specialized knowledge. It's not a personal services contract. Right. You know, plenty of people can go in here and operate it, so we're going to go ahead and allow the assumption. So it's pretty interesting, but in reality, we're not seeing that many, franchise bankruptcies. But the good news is I am seeing a lot more workouts by lenders, and I think that's promising. I think that lenders, franchisors, not necessarily landlords, they seem to have the most powerful position, but they know that it's not going to be good if this business goes dark. And they're willing to sit down and work something out, whether you re-amortize the loan, have an interest-only period, a forbearance agreement. A lot of times our lenders are allowing the franchisee time to find a new buyer to come in. And they're accepting short sales if it makes sense. But oftentimes as well, they have guarantees and guarantors on the hook. So they're going to look to the guarantor to, you know, maybe not make them 100% whole, but to at least contribute to the outcome. So it's very interesting.
So all this being discussed, Holly, all really goes back to, like, initially when an investor or potential franchisee is making their decision. One, you have to make sure that, you know, you're going to be able to make the investment and have cash reserve, and if you're getting financing to get working capital and to get interest only for a few months, and all these things are so crucial starting a new business. And the other side of the coin is, of course, to just make sure that you're not making a bad decision on a franchise system. So what would you, recommend to someone, to invest or potential franchisee, to maximize their chance that they're not making a wrong decision, that they're making a right decision on a franchise?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think that you really have to do your homework. You have to look at, I would look at the number of failures, the number of lawsuits, how aggressive this franchisor is with respect to when their franchises fail. And, you know, look at the age of it. Go for something that you like. I look out, like, for example, I mean, I don't even know if Build-A-Bear franchises. I think they may, but look at Build-A-Bear. Like, wow! I wish I would have thought of that. You know?
Right, that's true.
But part of it, it's probably better to get in early on a good franchise than it is to get in later, because the early part of the system, the royalty fees aren't so, you know, high at that point.
Right.
It's later on down the line when the franchise has success that they raise the royalty fees. And the terms may be a little more onerous than at the beginning of the system. It's definitely a difficult process, but you have to look at everything.
That's a very tough decision. You know, so what do you do if you're investing earlier? The franchise is younger, might be more opportunity, more room for growth. Like you said, the lower royalty fees, but at the same time, it could be more risk because it is a newer system. I think the bottom line is that you know, Marty and I have stressed this all throughout a couple of years of doing the show, is just make sure you're lining yourself up with specialists like yourself, like a franchise consultant who can help them with all the choices out there, and have an attorney to make sure you're reviewing the franchise agreement, the FDD. We've even had someone on to discuss information about the lease and all the negotiation that goes on there. So these are all such critical decisions in your business venture.
I think that's exactly right, and actually I've had this experience happen within the last few months where it was a franchise-owned store, and someone came in and took over the operation, but the franchise failed to inform them that there was a lien on all of the furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And so a guy comes in, he's been operating it for 6 months, and suddenly lender's saying, hey, pay up for my stuff or give it over, turn it over to me.
Oh, my God.
And I have to think that the person who stepped into that situation just didn't realize that there were other pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
You know, they thought, oh, I get the space, I get everything in it. You know, and
right.
I'm sure that the franchisor, their documentation probably said otherwise. But that just goes to show you why it's good to have a good consultant or an attorney or someone to advise you with respect to starting up a franchise.
How long do these disputes last, Holly? I mean, can some of them last years, the ones that you've worked on?
Just which kind of dispute?
I guess anything in general between a franchisee or franchisor, if they're not coming to an agreement on a particular issue.
It depends on the franchisor.
Mm-hmm.
I have a workout going on right now with it's probably like a 36 unit franchise where I represent the lender and they have a dispute with their franchisor over advertising, and that dispute has probably been going on for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a threat of we're going to close you down, and then
right.
there was a forbearance period. And so we're just waiting to see what happens, because whether or not we take the next step and restructure this debt depends on if there's going to be something to restructure at the end of the day. So some franchisors are very quick.
Right.
You know, we send out your default notice. You didn't cure. You're done. File the lawsuit.
Exactly.
You know,
there's more mediation,
letter.
I guess, going on, Holly, than in the past.
There's definitely... I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about having a mediator, and that I guess is used as another option.
Yeah, mediators can be good depending on the situation. Most of the time, mediators come in once there's been a lawsuit filed, and by that time, the franchisor or the lender has decided we're done, we're pulling the plug. It might be a good idea to get someone in before that time. I end up being on long conference calls where we're trying to work it out, where everyone's giving their position, and we see if we can come to an agreement. But, you know, there's parties that have more power than other parties.
Right.
And typically that's a franchisor and the lender. But it's good for the franchisee to understand, how it works and what the dynamics are when they're going into a workout situation with the franchisor and with the lender. Threatening bankruptcy, I've heard that for 16 years. That's not much of a threat to me, and that's only going to aggravate the situation. So I wouldn't run in there and just say, hey, we're filing, you can't do anything about it. I'd have a little more of an attitude of, hey, what can we do to get the situation turned around? We would really like to, or we would like to find the buyer. A lot of times the franchisors are good at locating someone, but keep the communication open, and that's going to be the best result for everyone, because if you just allow it to go dark, the franchisor or the lender or the landlord, they're all going to go after you, after the principal who guaranteed everything, could potentially force a bankruptcy. And no one wants to file bankruptcy. That's not
right.
The goal.
Right.
Now, it's interesting how you say there's less franchisor bankruptcies, but there's been more franchise systems failing. A lot of those older or newer systems, or is it a mixed bag of franchise systems going under?
It's mixed. We're seeing both old and new. And, you have to look at the cost of fuel, the sale of goods. If you look at restaurants, cheese, dairy, wheat,
right.
All of their costs of doing business have really gone up. And so it just makes it, they get to a point where they're like, I'm tired of doing this for no profit.
Right. Right,
I'm barely making ends meet. I'm dipping into my savings to make payroll or do whatever. And they just decide it's time to give up. I put up the white flag. It's not necessarily just the older systems.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. We read a story, it was like about a month, it was probably about 2 months ago, Holly, about with the rising gas prices, and all these delivery services, like these pizza places and Chinese restaurants, they're really feeling the pinch,
Oh, yeah.
So there's just so many factors involved in all of this.
Or they'll just pass it on to the customer. Yeah.
I know, but don't the customers get angry?
Sure.
I can't tell you, having to pay like a resort fee at a hotel or an extra gas fee on a delivery just irritates me.
Exactly.
Or $25 to check in your luggage,
Absolutely.
You can see your customers to death.
Oh, absolutely. Is there more disclosure, Holly, in the new, we have the shift from the UFOC to the FDD. Has there been any changes in the bankruptcy section for the FDD, or is that pretty much the same?
There's a lot more detail,
And
it definitely, I think you have to put all the ones that have closed, you have to list all the bankruptcies, you have to list all the litigation, you have to list whether or not they settled.
Right.
I can't remember if you have to put the amount of the settlement agreement. I'm getting ready to assist in this process, as we get ready to do the updates.
Make all
for
these
all
changes,
this
right. It sounds like there's more disclosure, with the FDD. I guess that was the biggest
There's a lot more
shift.
Disclosure. And I think that works to the franchisee's benefit extent, because the franchisor doesn't want to have five pages of disclosure on their problem children in the franchise systems.
Oh,
so,
absolutely.
It's better to come to an amicable resolution if possible.
Yeah, I agree. So what happens to the franchise agreement in bankruptcy, Holly?
Well, you can either reject it, and then it's back to the state court but by that time the restaurant's probably dark. They've decided to close the location. You assume it, which means they want to continue on with the relationship, and you're going to have to wait through the Chapter 11 process and see if they can get a plan confirmed. And as we discussed already, it's extremely rare to confirm a plan of reorganization. And one of the big things today is it's hard to find money in order to keep the ship afloat, so to speak.
Right.
During the bankruptcy process, the franchisor could ask the bankruptcy court to order the franchisee to make adequate protection payments, which means, hey, if you're going to continue to use our mark, continue to use our system, we need to be protected during the bankruptcy case, so please, let's require this franchisee to go ahead and make those monthly payments. You know, we can worry about the back payments through the plan of reorganization, but it's killing us to have our system in this bankruptcy and we're not getting paid. So that's the assumption route, and then, of course, the assumption and the assignment to a third person. Trying to think, from time to time there's litigation in the bankruptcy court where, you know, the franchisee blames the franchisor for its woes. So you actually could have a lawsuit within the bankruptcy, you know, saying that the franchisor engaged in some wrongdoing or the franchisor wrongfully terminated the agreement or didn't comply with the law when it terminated it. So there's a lot can happen. It's a very dynamic process. It's also a very expensive process, which is another reason why a lot of systems don't make it through the bankruptcy process. You know, if you had the money in the first place, you probably wouldn't need to file. No one really thinks about that it takes a lot of money to be in bankruptcy, especially in a Chapter 11 case. And a lot of that money gets eaten up by the administrative costs of the case.
This is all great information. It's just so crucial. Do you have any last words, Holly, of advice to our listeners?
Yeah, I do. And I think that really no franchisor wants to see one of its franchisees file bankruptcy because it negatively reflects upon the franchise system. But, you know, if they have a good relationship, then there's a chance that the franchisor is going to work with the franchisee to avoid bankruptcy, and the same goes true with the lender. And, you know, they might help them find a new franchisee to take over. They might work with them to figure out some operational issues, give them a break, and just basically help a franchisee who is experiencing difficulties. I've had some of my franchisors that end up doing settlement agreements where, you know, they'll accept something less than the full amount owing in order to make things right. You know, but if bankruptcy is inevitable, my advice is to make sure you act quickly and legally as a franchisor to enforce your rights and remedies under the license agreement before a bankruptcy case is filed, because that's going to be the cheapest way for the franchisor to get out. So I really think that the communication is the number one thing to take away from this, and that everyone needs to communicate, including the franchisor, the lessor, the franchisee, and the landlord, because that's really the only way you're going to survive the process when times are tough. And I think people are more willing to work now. So don't
stop
that line of
communication. Time for you. The next year, Holly, should be pretty interesting, the way the economy is. And,
busy.
Yeah, I'm sure you.
I am
very busy.
Swamped right now. But the good news is a lot of it is workout stuff. And
right.
I think people should take note of that, you know, there could be a way out if you just communicate.
Right. That's great. We have about 60 seconds, Holly. What's the best way for our listeners to get more information on you and your services? Is there any, like, websites they can refer to? We have a link on our show page, actually, to your page on Snell & Wilmer, I think it is.
Oh, yeah, www.swlaw.com.
Okay.
Is our website, and I mean, my number is 303-634-2087, and a lot of times I'm happy just to talk to someone for a few minutes if they have a question, and you know, that's no charge there. But it's a very interesting time, and we'll just have to see what happens. I think it's going to be a year or two before we come out of this kind of economic mess, so to speak. So, thank you guys so much for having
me. Thank you,
on
Holly.
You're
a fantastic guest. It was a great topic, and it was a really perfect timing to do a show like this, you know. So we definitely love to have you back in the near future and talk about some more stuff just like this.
Definitely.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Holly.
Thanks, Holly. Have a great day today.
You too. Bye.
Take care.
Great topic, huh, Don?
Yeah, something that has to be discussed because, unfortunately, stuff like this happens, you know, whether it's due to the economy or poor management, whatever, there's always going to be, you know, situations like that.
Right. I mean, but again, as Ali was saying, you know, it sounds like the key is, you know, that whole, you know, communication thing is, you know, just being honest and, you know, because just by delaying the whole thing, I mean, it's just going to be very costly to everybody, you know.
Right.
So
yeah.
There's really, it sounds like there are ways around this. So again, great topic. Again, we haven't done a show like this in 2 years, you know, but I'm glad we did it, you know. And so you did a good job. We have, what do we have next week? We have I Sold It.
William Fickman.
And he's one of the youngest franchisees, I don't want to say ever in the history of franchising, but he's pretty young, and I think he owns actually several I Sold It franchises. So that's going to be interesting. And I'm actually going to meet him personally in Chicago. I'm doing a presentation on franchising, and he's going to actually be there. He's won this big competition for something. So very successful entrepreneur, yeah. So I'm looking forward to having William on the show. And I know you got a busy week, so I'll let you go, Don, and we'll talk next week.
Okay. Have a good day, Marty.
You too, Don. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Blog Talk Radio.
Franchise Interviews on Blog Talk Radio, Asking the Franchipreneur Who Owns One. I'm your host, Marty McDermott, with my co-host, Don Johnson. And if you've ever dreamed about owning your own business, then you've come to the right place. Today we have a great show. We have a very special guest, Scott Sandberg, attorney for Snell & Wilmer. And Scott's going to discuss what to do if a franchise relationship falls apart. He'll also discuss such issues such as how to deal with intellectual property rights, copyrights, trademarks, non-compete agreements, etc. And that's coming up in segment 2 of Franchise Interviews on Blog Talk Radio. So stick around because we've got a great show. Our first segment today is being brought to you by the Aaron Sales and Lease Ownership Franchise Opportunity. And Aaron's is a new number 58 among franchise chains and worldwide sales. Aaron's is reinventing the way a growing and underserved market acquires furniture, electronics, appliances, and computers. Great time to join the Aaron's franchise family. Don, Happy New Year. Welcome back, my friend, to our first show of the year on Blog Talk Radio. How you doing, my friend?
Great, Marty. Happy New Year to you as well.
A cold one out there today, huh?
Yeah, it's winter. It's, I guess, for us, the two coldest months of the year.
Absolutely. So it's finally here, you know. Got a great show today, don't we?
Yeah, I'm excited. Our first show on Blog Talk Radio, and we're happy about the relationship. And, just excited about what we're going to be doing for the next year, all the great guests and information and shows we're going to put together for our listeners.
Absolutely. What have we got going on today, Don?
Well, today we're going to be meeting with Scott Sandberg, and we're excited about that. He's at the law firm Snell & Wilmer. I believe they're out of Denver, right? That same firm.
They are. You know,
Kevin Hine.
It's the same firm of Kevin Hine, and you know, we've had a lot of guests over the last year from Denver, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it's really a hotbed or growing area for franchisors and, you know, also franchisees. I'm not sure what the number is. I think Denver is one of the fastest growing cities, I guess.
I think so. It's become like the franchise capital of the United States, you know,
right.
So pretty interesting.
Yes, yeah, so you had a nice New Year's, Marty, and everything?
I did. It, you know, it was like we're becoming like old-timers, Don. You know, I mean, we definitely didn't make it to see the ball. I mean, Connie and I must have been asleep by like 10:30, you know. I mean, with the little one around this year, I mean, I tell you, he's exhausting us. You know?
Oh, that'll tire you out, yeah. I can remember those days with the twins as infants. You know, my wife and I just went out to dinner. We kept it pretty simple. We were back home by 10:30. And, you know, overall the holiday was nice, and now we're starting out the new year, so let's...
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, the holidays sure went by fast, you know. And did you set any New Year's resolutions?
You know, I always find myself really, basically talking about the same stuff. It always resorts back to business.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's
true. Just want to get bigger and better and try to attain our goals. I always,
right.
Each year I always write down marketing plans and goals, and I think that's important. You got to do that.
Absolutely. Here's a great article, Don, from a website called howtobuyafranchise.com, and the article is by Dr. John P. Hayes. I don't know if you've ever met him before, but he's at a lot of the franchise shows every year, typically at the one in Washington that we go to, and does a lot of speaking
right.
on franchising. And the article is broken down into five parts. It's called Franchise Pre-Investment Checklist. Listen to some of this. It says, first things first, it says, read about franchising to learn what it's about, and understand that franchising is not for everyone, and it may not be for you. There's a lot of misconceptions on franchising, aren't there? You know, that you and I have covered over the last year. You know, a lot of people think that sometimes it runs on automatic pilot. You know, some people think that they can use their creative juices and kind of change the system, you know. And
there's a lot of guests we've had on the show, definitely. Everyone mentions you really have to do your due diligence and just make sure you're going to be comfortable and happy going this route, going into franchising. You're in business for yourself. It's not completely.
Not completely, though.
Yeah.
Right. And if, I don't know if you noticed, on today's show, I actually did a twist to our tagline, Asking the Entrepreneur Who Owns One, changing it to Asking the Franchipreneur Who Owns One. I don't know if you remember when we had Jim Cohen on the show,
right.
but he kept referring to the term franchipreneur because there is a difference between a franchipreneur and an entrepreneur.
Right.
You know, so kind of a little twist to our
I did catch that, by the way.
You did? Okay, good. You were paying attention.
Yeah.
listen to this. It says, understand that franchising is a system, it's very important, of distribution, and understand that the franchisor creates the system and the franchisees follow it. So as going back to our great guest, Michael Gerber, that we had on our show 6 months ago, and we actually just ran it on Blog Talk several weeks ago, the creator of the franchise is the true entrepreneur, while the franchisee is supposed to follow the system. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. And, you know, the franchisees that we've had on the show throughout the year, Don, the successful franchisees anyway, I mean, they all said to us the same thing. They said, you know what, all I did was follow the system, and that's why I became so successful.
Right.
You know, so very, very important. So
that's all you have to do, yeah.
Absolutely, it's just following the system. You know, and the one that made the biggest impact on me was when we had the gentleman from Liberty Tax on the show, you know, and that's what he said. He said, I'm not a creative guy. I just followed the system and became one of the top franchisees of all time. So that's
exactly
incredible.
What the franchisor wants. Someone like that is willing to work hard.
Absolutely.
Follow the system. It's really that simple. And, you know, if you're a creative type of guy and have some suggestions, most franchisors will listen to it. But,
right.
It's just a matter of following the system, and, you know, you should do fine.
Absolutely. Also says, part two, focus on you. Some interesting things here. It says, how do you want to spend the next 10 or more years of your life? You know, a lot of times you and I have compared this whole franchising thing to a marriage, haven't we? You know, I mean, 10 years is a long time, 120 months. I mean, that's typically the commitment that you're going to be making, you know. So how do you want to spend the next 10 years of your life?
You got to think long term, yeah.
Sure, absolutely. Test your franchise compatibility. You know, we've had a lot of franchise consultants on the show talking about that. Understand that most franchisors require their franchisees to be owner-operators as opposed to absentee owners. That's probably another misconception you probably get out there, you know, with people wanting to buy a Subway and thinking that it just kind of runs on automatic pilot, you know.
Right,
and
just hire a manager, everything will be fine, but...
And it's not the way it works.
Right.
Do you plan to work alone or with others? You know, are you a people person? Identify the industries that interest you, then pick the one that you love. Last week, you and I went over, we gave a list of, I think it was about 80 industries in franchising today.
Right.
You know, and I think we're up to about 2,500 different opportunities here in the United States. So there's just so much to choose from. And, you know, you use the word frequently, I use it, due diligence.
Right.
So important.
That's why many franchise consultants are having success. There's just
absolutely.
So many opportunities. You gotta, it can be overwhelming.
I think it's overwhelming. I mean, you know, when you and I go to the shows, you know, I mean, when you first walk into that convention hall in Washington, I mean, you see all those opportunities. And, again, it's probably usually only about, like, 300 to 500. I mean, it's just, it's incredible looking at all these different opportunities, you know. So it's amazing. Interesting. Okay. What else? It says, understand that there's a time to buy a franchise and a time to sell it. How much money do you have to invest? part three, it says focus on the company. It says request information from the franchise companies of your choice. This is an interesting one because, you know, if the franchise is not getting back to you, that might be an indication that something is something's wrong there, you know?
Red flag, right.
Absolutely. Evaluate the potential for your franchise choice. Visit the franchisor. Be prepared to ask questions. And, you know, you and I mentioned, ask lots of questions.
Right.
Come
prepared. Also on the financing side.
Absolutely.
Know your credit score. Know your net worth. How much cash you can invest or how much cash reserve. And
right.
Do your homework on that franchise. So when you're speaking to them, they'll be impressed that you know the history of that franchise.
Absolutely. You know, and that was interesting, too. I mean, even when you go to the shows, Don, you know, to, as you say, come prepared, you know. I mean, kind of get an idea of what industries you're interested in, what
right.
franchises you might be interested in, because there is no way you're going to get to talk to every single franchise
right.
that's there. You know, typically when I'll come on a Saturday morning, and I only get to talk to maybe about 20 or 30 of them, you know. I mean, it's just
right.
time goes by so fast.
It does, yeah.
Let's see. See the list of franchisees. This step is critical for your success. Talk to the franchisor's vendors. That's an interesting one.
Right.
Part four, focus on the financial requirements. And this is your area. It says, understand the financial commitments required by your franchise of choice. Understand the royalty fee and know why you must pay it. Right? It shouldn't be a painful experience to send that royalty.
Right, you're going to want to pay the royalty because
exactly.
that's what's making the whole wheel turn. That money goes towards advertising. The franchisor is helping you support.
Right.
It's important, yeah.
Absolutely. Understand the advertising fee and how it'll be used. You know, a lot of times when you buy a franchise, you know, we've seen like Subway or, you know, Burger King. I mean, you know, these franchises typically have commercials on the Super Bowl, you know,
right.
and we have the Super Bowl coming up soon.
Right.
I mean, you'll see some big-name franchisers advertise on the Super Bowl. I mean, that's something that Tony's Pizzeria can't do, you know?
Right.
How much money will you need to start and initially operate the business? Prepare a business plan. I mean, even when it is a franchise, you know, a lot of times we've had questions, Don, you know, should I prepare a business plan even if it's a franchise? And, you know, the answer is absolutely yes, you know?
Right.
And you guys at Diamond help your clients do all that stuff as well, put a nice package together.
You're very important, Paul.
Absolutely.
Just getting back to goals, what I was just talking about, you mentioned New Year's resolution.
Right.
You know, you definitely got to have a short and long-term plan.
Absolutely.
A business plan.
It really forces you to think things through, you know, as,
right.
as you're writing that business plan. So very, very important. Last part is part five, ask for help, but seek it wisely. This is interesting. Tap into your franchise sales representative's professional network. Common theme almost on every other show, I would say, is consult with a franchise attorney. Very important, and we're having Mr. Sandberg on the show today. So, you know, he'll talk about you know, his advice to aspiring entrepreneurs looking to buy a franchise. Consult with a franchise wise accountant. You know, that's also important. Negotiate any open issues with the franchisor and sign the franchise agreement and go for it. So, I thought it was a great article to kind of start the year, you know, and kind of set the tone for franchising. And again, you know, you and I frequently emphasize to many aspiring entrepreneurs that franchising is certainly not for everybody. It's probably not for most people.
Right.
So, yeah, be very, very
cautious. And then if you do move forward and go in that direction, just make sure you cover all these points.
Absolutely.
Because you should basically have about 100 questions when you're looking at a particular franchise.
Oh, absolutely. I think
it's important, the last part, you know, getting a franchise, you know, just not an attorney, just not an accountant, someone who specializes.
Right, understanding, right, you know, royalty fees and things like that. Absolutely, it's so important. So,
and then of course we're always high on, you know, even go out there and take it one step further and speak to a franchise consultant.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, franchise consultants, you know, certainly serve a fantastic purpose. I mean, they can certainly guide you towards, you know, particular industries. You know, we had Carol Mercurio on the show of Matchpoint. I mean, she does an excellent job at, you know, kind of finding out, you know, what your needs are. You know, do you want to spend time at home?
Right, she'll bring up a lot of questions
that you would never think of, you know? Absolutely. So I just thought it was very interesting. You had an interesting article that I know you wanted to discuss. I believe it was from franchise.org.
Yeah, I want to continue that. We discussed a little bit last week. Before that, I just want to remind people a couple franchise shows coming up.
That's right.
Franchise Expo South is next weekend, Marty, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, January 11th to the 13th. It's one of the largest franchise shows down at Miami Beach Convention Center.
Okay.
People can go to franchiseexposouth.com to hear all about that show. And then our friends at
National Event Management put on the Franchise and Business Opportunities Expo. There's a show out in Las Vegas, Marty, January 19th and 20th.
Oh, great.
And then in Cleveland, January 26th and 27th, having a franchise show. Anybody want to get information on those shows can simply go to franchiseshowinfo.com.
Absolutely. And the shows, again, are a lot of fun to go to. You know, I mean, again, bring your appetite, you know, because it's going to be a lot of different franchises there, a lot of food franchises, you know, and I usually leave those things with a stomachache, you know, so.
And if you're low on pens.
There you go. You bought some interesting gifts back last year, if I remember correctly, didn't you?
Yeah, I always go and I grab, some little gifts for the kids, little cars, balls. There's all kinds of company and franchise promotional items, which are, you always end up bringing home with you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this article, Marty, through International Franchise Association, Franchising World Magazine, October issue, tenants don't get the lease they deserve, but the one they negotiate. And talked about this a little bit last week, because this is such an important part, people going through the franchise process. You've chosen your franchise, you've done all your due diligence, and most people owning a franchise have to lease space in a
right
situation. And this is a crucial part, because, again, this is a long-term type of commitment, and there's so many people make mistakes. It's by Dale Willerton, it's like a boxing match, punch and jab, it says. Negotiating a great or even just a good lease or renewal can be challenging for both franchise companies and their franchisees. When it comes to site selection, there's a jungle of real estate choices and opportunities out there that few tenants know how to maneuver. First one is negotiate to win. All too frequently, franchise tenants enter into lease negotiations unprepared to do, not even try winning the negotiations. It's almost as if they are applying for the privilege of paying the landlord rent money for 5 or 10 years. If one is not negotiating to win, one won't. With big commissions at stake, people can be sure the landlord's agent is negotiating to win, and so should the franchise tenant. So people should really go in with the mentality of they could negotiate, just don't settle on whatever the offer is.
Right, right.
It says here, create competition for your tenancy. Tenants must negotiate on multiple sites if they expect to get the best possible deal. If a franchisee falls in love with one location, they often neglect to consider alternate locations.
Interesting.
That's a good point. Someone might
find that, is, absolutely,
that site, hey, I want to be at that site, and that's it.
Right.
They might have lousy lease terms. So it's important to kind of give yourself a few different options. In financing, a lot of times it's tough. You know, people lose their site location, but
right,
they always end up finding a site they like. Usually it's not their first choice, but they're happy because they're happy with the lease terms as well.
I think when we had Ryan Sandberg on the show, Don, I mean, he mentioned that, you know, it's very rare that, you know, when someone finds, like, their first choice, you know, that they end up going with that particular selection, too, you know, so,
right.
You know, and it's really, you know, by doing that, you're putting all your eggs in one basket as well, you know, you don't want to do that.
Right.
You know, I mean, this gives you the power, when you have some choices, you can negotiate, I think that's what the article is actually saying, you know, is,
right.
You know, a lot of people have trouble with the negotiation part, you know, or they just don't know that they can do it. You know, I guess the question is why.
Or people aren't good at it, or it's they just feel funny doing it. They don't want to. They like a location. They feel if they negotiate or try to get better terms, the landlord might say, "Oh, I'm just going elsewhere."
Right.
But that's just that's just how the game is played.
Absolutely.
Also, it says be prepared to walk away. Try and set aside emotions and make objective decisions. Whoever most needs to make a lease deal will give up the most concessions. Without burning any bridges, try walking away from the deal and see if the landlord's agent comes running after.
That's interesting.
If he does, then one can negotiate from a stronger position and get what is wanted.
Right.
That's a good point. Another one, ask the right questions. Gathering information about what other tenants are paying for rent and what leasing incentives they receive,
right,
asking the right questions will position one to get a better deal. Consider that the landlord and his agent know what every other tenant in the property is paying in rent. They also know who got the most free rent and tenant allowance.
Interesting.
Yeah. Brokers, friend or foe, real estate brokers and their agents typically work for the landlord who's paying their commissions. Some franchise systems mistakenly let real estate agents who are being paid by the landlord represent their valuable franchisees. If the landlord is paying the agent a hefty commission, then the landlord expects the agent to get him the highest rental rate, the largest deposit, and the greatest security or personal guarantee possible. So, keep that in mind when you're out there trying to negotiate a lease. Site selection no-nos, it says here, Marty. Never let one agent who is being paid by landlords to show an interested party space around town or show another agent's listing.
That makes sense.
Always conduct site selection by directly contacting the listing agent for each property. Multiple tenants are trying to lease the same location. The listing agent may be motivated to conduct a deal with a tenant that came to him directly versus a tenant introduced by an outside agent who will now split the commission.
Right.
Also, never accept the first offer. Even if the first offer to lease seems reasonable or one simply has no idea of what to negotiate for, never accept the leasing agent's first offer. In the real estate industry, many things are negotiable and most landlords fully expect to receive a counteroffer.
Huh, interesting.
Ask more than you. If the tenant needs 3 months of free rent, then ask for 5 free months.
There you go. I mean, why not ask? You know, I mean, what's the worst that can happen?
Right.
You know, if they say no.
No one ever gets more than he asks for, but one should be prepared for the landlord to counteroffer and negotiate as well. Don't be afraid of hearing no from the landlord. Counteroffers are all part of the game. Avoid 5-year terms. For a franchisee to open a store in an enclosed shopping center or retail strip plaza,